often imitated, never duplicated. This is the one and only Fash the Nation, your guiding light in a sea of degeneracy.
Hello and welcome to episode 217 of Fash the Nation. I'm Jazz Hands McFeels, joined, as always, by Marcus Halberstrand. Marcus, how's your week going, guy?
It's going all right. Well, I'm, you know, as far as, like, me personally, and everything's all right. The weather's good. As far as the Trump administration, not so much. But I enjoyed the show that you did with Ethnarc, and particularly your content on the China trade situation. It was interesting. My dad actually had just spoken to me about it recently, and the way he sees it, I don't know if he got this from somewhere, but the way that he figures it, 6% growth is the target that Xi must maintain and cannot miss. And he was like, they can't do it with their own innovation. I'm telling you this right now.
Yeah, no, they can't. The whole thing is a house of cards that's dependent on just theft of intellectual property from our corporations, who are seemingly willing to give it to them in the name of cheap labor and globo shlomo. So yeah, it's really.
Well, it's always like they always do these deals where it's like, if you want to get into our market, you know, you're going to build a plant here, or you're basically just going to like turn over whatever we want from you, or you're not accessing this market, and then, you know, eventually we'll just. You'll just see this, your product, on the market under our shingle.
Well, this is what happens when you have members of corporate boards who don't have sort of a nationalist, patriotic interest. I mean, what if you don't really give a shit about America or give a shit about American workers, and all you do is give a shit about a dollar? Why would you really care? As long as the job gets done and you get paid and you get a golden parachute and shit, you know?
Yeah, such as it is.
Yeah. So I saw this this sort of blow up with Donald Trump today. We have Trump at top of the stack again because he really is just becoming such a national embarrassment. I was driving the car and I had CNN on. And as I usually flip through the different stations, and I heard, you know, the CNN was sort of like, I heard them talking about they're rolling the risers out, and we've been given the 2-minute warning to the president's address, and Chuck and Nancy have left the White House, and apparently they were there, and then they left very quickly. And so the president is going to be making some sort of a news conference, presumably about infrastructure. And then I don't even know who this was at CNN, but she was just like, oh, wait, oh, now we're getting from our producers that the address from the president is going to be about Mueller. So apparently it's not going to be about infrastructure. I guess what we're hearing now is it's going to be about Mueller, and something went wrong at the meeting. I was just like, oh, shit. I mean, I thought it was probably going to be about infrastructure, too, because that was really the only reason why Chuck and Nancy would be going there. And I think Trump invited them there, right? I mean, that was the whole premise of this meeting.
Yeah, no, this was absolutely scheduled, you know, to be a discussion about this ostensibly $2 billion infrastructure package.
$2 trillion, my friend. $2
trillion. Oh, yeah, yeah. $2 trillion. Yeah, I had seen, well, this morning that he, you know, basically, the first headline that I saw on Politico was Trump says we're not doing infrastructure until the USMCA is approved. And that was basically kind of all that I saw. I had no idea all this drama ensued with the meeting with Chuck and Nancy. I heard a little bit. I heard some of her responses on the way home in the car, you know, where she's rambling on about, you know, maybe he didn't have the confidence or whatever, et cetera, et cetera. But
he has a small small penis. That's why the negotiations didn't go well, according to Nancy. It's hard to take Trump's side or to take Trump's side, though, against her. I mean, she's such a despicable person. But yeah, I mean, the way that I understood the way this went down was, I mean, I didn't even know that he had said no infrastructure until the new NAFTA gets approved. I didn't even know that he had said that. Now the position is no legislation at all until these investigations stop. But it's like, dude, didn't you realize that that was kind of the deal anyway? Investigations are never going to stop, and you're not going to get a deal with these people. What are they going to come to the table with you on, except like condemning white nationalists? That's like the only bipartisan thing you're going to get out of these people.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, you know, everyone sort of had their misgivings about it going in. Yeah, I was trying to find this Politico article. Yeah, so apparently this was a letter. This was sort of setting the stage for all of this, I guess. I don't know if his blow up was impromptu or he was planning it even the night before, but on the eve of a highly anticipated meeting with Democrats, at which they're talking about infrastructure, blah, blah, blah. Before we get into infrastructure, he says in the letter, it is my strong view that Congress should first pass the important popular USMCA deal, blah, blah, blah. He also stipulated that his preference to meld any infrastructure package with recurring authorization for highway. Yeah, so like I was saying before, have it be like a traditional transportation infrastructure bill as opposed to this sort of basically stimulus 2.0. And then he said, it would be helpful if you came to tomorrow's meeting with your infrastructure priorities and specifics regarding how much funding you would dedicate to each. Your caucus has expressed a wide range of priorities, and it is unclear which ones you have your support.
Yeah, and I can see now why you said $2 billion. In the Washington Post, it says $2 billion infrastructure plan. Come on. Can't these people like find people to edit this stuff? It's such a glaring mistake that it's $2 billion. It's like that's enough to keep like four blacks employed in the city of Chicago for, I don't know, with a couple managers for like 2 or 3 years. It's $2 billion doesn't go very far. But yeah, I mean the way that I saw how this all shook out. Now I didn't know about the NAFTA thing that could have poisoned sort of the meeting if they had scheduled it in advance, and I think that was the case. But what really poisoned this thing was, I guess, Nancy Pelosi, I think, a couple hours before... let me back up even more. Trump woke up this morning and started tweeting all kinds of crazy shit, like all caps, you know, they hate this president, like at 6 a.m., presidential, you know, all this stuff. I don't even have them in front of me. But Trump started wiling out on Twitter. Nancy calls a Democratic caucus meeting, and at that caucus meeting, she says Donald Trump is in the process of participating in a cover-up. Trump hears about those comments, I guess, right before Chuck and Nancy showed up at this meeting at the White House. And apparently, from what I read, and I don't have the thing in front of me for whatever gay reason.
I heard he just walked in and it was like on.
Yeah, he didn't shake hands. He didn't sit down. He just basically said, it said, instead of walking in happily to a meeting, I walk in to look at people who said I was doing a cover up, Trump said, adding that he can't work on infrastructure under these circumstances. I had this right in front of me, and now it's disappeared. There's something about where he just walked in and, like, walked out. Oh, yeah, Trump was visibly angry when he arrived in the cabinet room about 15 minutes late to meet with Chuck and Nancy. According to people familiar with what transpired, Trump did not shake hands or sit down, and after accusing Pelosi of saying something, quote, terrible, he headed out without even allowing a time for a response. So he basically, like, rage quit these negotiations. And I guess Debbie Stabenow was at the meeting, said that after directing his anger toward Pelosi, he said it was over, that he wasn't going to do infrastructure or anything else until the investigations are over. And then he went out and delivered this speech. And I was telling you on the phone, the man I heard going out to the podium sounds like a guy in dire straits. Like, it's almost like...
Yeah.
They wanted him to react this way, and he did.
Well, I mean, I don't know. It's, you know, he probably feels besieged. Like the Mueller probe ended, you know, and it ended, you know, whatever the question about obstruction. I don't think there was any obstruction. There was no underlying crime. You know, it says there's no collusion with Russia, and I would assume was expecting something very different than this, because it's not only as if fucking nothing changed. It essentially has, you know, intensified with, you know, Gerald Nadler and his associate, Mr. Schiff.
Well, that's all.
So, I mean, if he was thinking that things were going to be different and then is hit with this, I don't know, maybe he had a little bit of a break.
Yeah, I mean, there is, and we're going to get to that here in a second, there is this whole impeachment piece that is ramping up now, and Pelosi is trying her best to sort of keep the dam intact, but the dam on this is looking like it's going to break at some point. And, you know, I'm sure there are people out there, 4D chess narratives, saying that Trump maybe blew this up on purpose to prompt impeachment. There would be a time where I'd, you know, think he would be that Machiavellian, but I see him as very reactionary. And I think, yeah, maybe the anger is justified, which is what you're saying, because of the way that these people, what they've been saying. I mean, it is an insult. Set orange faggot aside for a second. Like, if you were having an in-good-faith meeting about trying to do some sort of bipartisan infrastructure bill in a serious way, and 3 hours before that meeting, someone who is going to participate in that good-faith negotiation said that you were in the process of covering up crimes while in the White House, I mean, I'd be pretty pissed, too.
Yeah, I mean, especially, you know, like I said, the Mueller report is conclude these people, you know, want to chimp out about, you know, whether or not there was obstruction of justice. Now they're not even, they're trying to, you know, get him just on the fact that he's not willing to cooperate. I think appropriately, as far as I'm concerned, you know, with all this shit, it's like you got the report, Barr's getting you the stuff that you want. And, you know, and he didn't even need to fucking give you that, by the way. You guys were the ones that changed law after, you know, you didn't want, after the Starr report was splashed all over fucking Washington. You guys decided you didn't like that. So fuck yourself.
Yeah, well, the one shitty thing, too, about this is that Trump has accepted this narrative that the Russians did collude in the election, just not with his campaign. Because during this address, he says, no collusion, no obstruction, and then adds the qualifier, insofar as my campaign was concerned. So he's already accepting this shitty narrative that, like, Russians hacked the election, which is what the Democrats want to be able to do. They want to be able to run out there, and Trump has conceded this point. And I don't care what
he had been fairly disciplined about really not talking about that, because everyone, you know, and then people would be like, oh, well, Russians did collude. It's like, yeah, but he can't say that, because if he starts referring to that, like, you're just you basically that's a euphemism for the whole thing has become a euphemism for him directly colluding with Vladimir Putin. So it's prudent to avoid it, which he sort of did for a while. But yeah, what he really should be like is like, you know, so no election machines were hacked. We've had this conversation before. It's like they were, you know, posting memes on Facebook. It's like, this is, you know, we have a democracy, you know, that's universal suffrage. It's extremely open. You know, all the locks are off everything. This is how you wanted it. These are things that you have to deal with. Like, what the fuck are we even talking about here?
Well, even and more beyond that is the point that it's only collusion because it's a white country, a very large white country that is involved. But if it's a very tiny Jewish country that's involved, or really anybody else, as long as they're part of Globo Shlomo's narrative, it's fine. That's the point, is that it's only collusion. It's only a problem because it's Russia. If it was anybody else, it's just, you know, that's our democracy, Goy. That's our democracy at work. But it's like you can't have this, like, sort of, like you said, open, like, illegal immigrants streaming across the border. And, you know, we've made this point before. It's like, you want to talk about Russian collusion? Let's talk about non-citizen voting. But they don't want to have that conversation. But we elected Trump thinking that we'd have somebody who could force them to have that conversation. But instead, Trump adds the qualifier, oh, no collusion as far as my campaign was concerned. But, I mean, whatever those intelligence you know, agencies say about other stuff. I don't know, you know. It's like, what the fuck, guy? But, you know, whatever. There's no point in holding out hope for this guy anymore. But it was funny, the Schumer quote. To watch what happened in the White House would make your jaw drop, Schumer said. Of course, I don't really know how angry Trump got in this meeting. Because it's always just, you know, of course Schumer's going to say that even if Trump just didn't shake his hand and that was it. But this is definitely an interesting development. I mean, I don't know what Trump's plan is until these investigations complete. Why don't you fight back? But nah, he just, I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, to have, you know, the bit about trade and then do this. I mean, if you just wanted to have the trade thing be, you know, the grenade that you drop into these talks by sending a letter the evening before, you know, that makes a certain amount of sense, but both not necessarily. It kind of reminds me of that time Boehner was in somebody's office, and I guess I want to say Harry Reid was, you know, in the lobby, the ante room or whatever, you know, because, you know, a lot of these offices on the Hill, especially as you get higher up, it's not, you know, just a little office that you're in. It's like a fucking suite. He comes out of the office. Reid is sitting on, like, the couch or something, and he just points his finger at Reid as he's walking by and is like, fuck you.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I mean, if Trump's strategy is to push them toward impeachment, I mean, this would be a way to do it. But, I mean, why would you... I mean, to buy into that narrative means that you'd also buy into the narrative that he's abandoning his plans for infrastructure. It's like, okay, well, then why even bring it up? I mean, I don't know. Maybe there's no hope that they were ever going to do an infrastructure bill. I mean, you and I were talking about that. It's like, on the one side, you have Democrats who essentially just want subsidies for dildos, and on the other side of the chasm, you have Republicans doing the more fiscal responsibility routine, where they don't want to spend a fucking dollar. Like, they'll spend billions of dollars on Israel, they'll spend billions of dollars on foreign aid around the world, but they won't repair one fucking bridge in middle America, because, like, fuck white people,
yeah.
I guess.
Well, speaking of middle America, that's an interesting thing that I suspect we probably would have seen if there actually was a legit back and forth on infrastructure. I think at this point, like, there would have been Democrats, like, you know, openly trying to steer money, like, away from white America and, you know, into... all of our wonderful urban centers and so on.
Underserved communities. Is that the word you're looking for? Underserved? Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, they're underserved. They're underserved by the fucking police.
Yeah. Yeah, very underserved. Yeah, in a food desert. It's like, there's no food desert. It's just that these people don't want to fucking cook for themselves.
So,
anyway.
Yeah, anyway, there was this... Yeah, the meeting this morning was detailed in this AP article that I have here, basically talking about how a growing number of rank-and-file Dems are incensed by Don McGahn's refusal to appear, and the chorus of people that had been calling for impeachment had been getting stronger before that even happened. But this is, I guess, sort of giving these people the rationale that they feel they need. Yeah, Pelosi summoned them. Still a small fraction of the House Democratic caucus, these people shilling for impeachment, to a meeting of investigators Wednesday to assess the strategy. Some other Democrat leaders, while backing Pelosi, signaled that a march to impeachment may at some point become inevitable. We are confronting what may be the largest, broadest cover-up in American history, Majority Leader Steny Hoyer told reporters. If a House inquiry leads to other avenues, including impeachment, so be it. So
yeah.
That's not some dickhead backbencher. That's Steny Hoyer. You know, we all know him,
and he represents this more conservative, I guess you could say, white conservative wing of the Democratic Party. I mean, Steny Hoyer is someone who colluded with someone else to prevent a primary challenge from succeeding, because it was like the AOC wing that was trying to perpetrate this primary challenge. And so for him to come out there and say that is big. I mean, this is what's been brewing. So that's why, I mean, Trump's reaction to Chuck and Nancy makes even less sense, because if his strategy is to get impeachment proceedings started, then all he had to do was just sit back and let him do it. I mean, unless the whole plan...
He didn't need to seem unreasonable to provoke these people into doing whatever they're going to do. My read is it's coming down the pike.
Yeah, it's coming down the pike because they're... Now, a while ago, you know, 20 years ago, the Democratic Party wouldn't have been able to totally control this. But they have a foothold of non-whites in their party who are pushing for this. A lot of the star, I think Al Green is the guy who was like the Al Green and Maxine Waters are the ones that were really the first people that sort of have kept this impeachment vigil going until it actually became a thing. And now I think this week, 20 other House Democrats have signed on to this. And there was a late night meeting on Monday night between Gerald Nadler and Nancy Pelosi about basically going along with, come on, Nancy, we got to move forward with this thing. I know you don't want to do it, but you're really going to have no choice at a certain point. And that seems to be what's happening. What they're trying to concoct, though, is some sort of way where they can seem like they're edging toward impeachment. That's what the constitutional crisis shit was all about. Like, let's declare that there's a constitutional crisis, but like not actually doing anything about it. You know, this is what the Republican Party is famous for doing to its base. It's what the Democrat establishment is doing to its as well.
Yeah. Well, I mean, like I said, at this point, you know, I think that they want to do it, you know, and just have the rationale be that the administration is not, you know, allowing Congress to conduct its proper oversight role. Now the real resolution of this is, you know, it needs to go to the court and be adjudicated. You know, you have two branches of government telling each other to fuck off. You know, whether or not judicial review is appropriate, the way the system works these days is that there's no it doesn't really matter until the court comes down one way or the other.
Well, Trump is in a way, by telling McGahn he can't testify and invoking an executive privilege, he is speeding it toward this conclusion. But I mean, if you believe, you know, the news reports that a lot of what's driving Trump's anger is that he's upset about impeachment in private. So what's the game then? You know how Nancy a couple weeks ago said Trump is trying to goad us into impeachment. What's the game? To like try to goad them into impeachment and then, you know, hope that they're bluffing? Because if you goad them into impeachment and they actually do it and your fear behind the scenes is that you're going to get impeached, guy, like, I got news for you. They're coming. Like, they're coming fast. And there's more and more pressure on Nancy now, like, to do this. And, I mean... The fact that he's denying these document requests makes it even more possible, because you were saying about the courts. I wanted to say this one thing really quick is they can get a judge will rule more favorably on granting these document requests and granting these witness interviews if it's an impeachment proceeding. If it's not an impeachment proceeding, they have a much more difficult time. So by Trump saying no to all this shit, it makes it easier for these establishment Democrats to sort of justify. It's like, well, he's not giving us the documents. He's not giving us the witness testimony. So the only way we can do that is through an impeachment proceeding. So let's do this.
Well, I mean, I think that he probably should have just kept doing that. You know, if it's coming, you may as well goad them into it at this point. You don't need to have this blow up about, you know, because that's a compelling case, you know, not just necessarily to Trump's base. Be like, look, we've been through all of this. I'm just not complying with this fucking lawfare with all these fucking shitty fucking Jew lawyers. I'm done.
Yeah. And I mean, if Donald Trump was like fighting the good fight for us and doing things on our behalf and speaking not implicitly, but explicitly about the forgotten white men and women of America, I would feel a lot more, you know, I feel a lot more invested in this fight. I'm just kind of like back to where I was in 2016 and before, which is like, dude, just let it all fucking burn. I mean, I don't want the I don't want the J left to score a propaganda win here, but at the same time, like the whole thing is going stern up in the air. So,
yeah, well, that's the other interesting dynamic. You know, if an impeachment fight be over the horizon, you got to kind of be 100% for certain that your base is ready to ride with you.
That's what I'm saying. Is I don't even remember which show that I said this on, because it sort of runs together. But I think Trump, because he's in this information bubble, has been shielded from how underwhelming his support has become. And I'm not even I'm saying that with full recognition and consciousness of the fact that, like, I'm not sitting here as someone who is on the alt-right saying that and being like, well, Donald didn't give me the things that I wanted, this buffet of issues, this alt-right issues that I wanted, and now his base doesn't like him. Go look at the comment sections of Breitbart. I mean, it's happening. There are – I saw there was this story, and it didn't make it into the prep, but I saw that, like, at Trump's Pennsylvania rally, they – he had to stop speaking 5 or 6 times because of medical emergencies at the rally. It's because these are all boomers who are there. It's like, before long, the rallies are just going to be like all fat diabetic boomers who are like collapsing due to various like medical conditions. These aren't young people. This is like all boomers like hoping for one more hurrah with America. That's like what Trump's base is going to become. I mean, when it's all that's said and done, like they'll ride with him, but it's like... all the way to the emergency room on a gurney. It's like,
yeah, well, there's an interesting article in the Hill outlining why this might be a good strategy for Trump, but it was more geared toward why Nancy Pelosi is super concerned about this. And it starts with the latest NBC Wall Street Journal approval poll numbers, where Trump is at 46, matching his 2016 popular vote percentage, despite Democrats' incessant pursuit and media coverage. Trump is where he was when he was elected, and he's probably higher because the poll in this instance did not sample likely voters with whom Trump actually tends to score higher. On the poll's question whether Congress should begin impeachment hearings now, only 17% agreed, while 48% disagreed, 3-1, also not too good. Then you have the fact that 31 House Democrats hold districts that Donald Trump won in 2016. That's could get very dicey as well, looking to win the White House and take back the House or maintain control of the House. And then you have the fact that with just 47 seats in the Senate, they would need to hold all of them in an impeachment vote, including those from states that Trump won or did very well in, and pick up 20 Republicans. In 1999, Republicans with 55 seats failed to get a simple majority to convict Bill Clinton. 20 years later, Democrats would be trying to do the same thing with 8 fewer seats.
Yeah, it's not going to happen. I mean, the Senate is the big roadblock here. But I think the thinking of the AOC wing of the party and the people that are really pushing for impeachment is that it's like, okay, well, then let's make the Senate the thing that we campaign against then. The Senate is the reason why the orange racist president is still in office. And if we want to pick up some seats in the Senate, we'll just blame the Senate for not getting this done. It is a sound strategy if Nancy was willing to pursue it. But she wants to play it safe for whatever reason at the moment. And I don't know. It's really going to come down to her. And part of the problem as well, like in the intra-Democratic Party politics, is that the people pushing for impeachment are the ones, of course, that are in like pure blue districts. The ones who don't want to do impeachment because of the polling data that you just read are the ones that won last time in districts that are really pro-Trump. And in a presidential election year, they're probably going to go. It's going to be very difficult for a lot of those Democrats to hold those seats. So they
no, Pelosi has said that specifically. It's like these people, you know, banging the loudest for impeachment are not the people who have delivered us the House majority.
Yeah, no, they're not. Yeah, they were using Katie Hill as an example. It said some freshman Democrats from competitive districts such as Katie Hill of California, Jason Crow of Colorado, Lisa Slotkin of Michigan are siding with Mrs. Pelosi and Mr. Jeffries, saying they back the ongoing investigations but must take action on their party's agenda. So, yeah, I mean, and then you have the other side of the coin is, you know, AOC. Failure to impeach now is a neglect of due process. Jayapal, she agrees that it has to be done as well. And then complicating this for Trump and the Republican Party is Justin Amash, which may not seem like a big deal, whatever, that Amash did this and came out and said that he supports impeachment after having read the Mueller report. The problem with this is that it gives the Democrats just a little bit of cover, all the cover that they need to say it's a bipartisan impeachment effort. And if they can convince, you know, all it takes, you know, it's this sort of, I don't know, peer pressure mentality, sort of groupthink. If Amash has thrown his name in the ring, you know, who else on the Republican side? There are probably about maybe 10, 15, 20 members of Congress who I could see on the Republican side supporting impeachment as well, because they're cucks, they're faggots.
Yeah, I mean, eventually, but it's, I think that's a long way off. I mean, Amash is kind of fucking spurgy. Like, you know, he fancies himself as like a Ron Paul type figure, but he's just, a fucking shitty brown person at the end of the day.
Well, he's a Palestinian, though. So he is. He does have some pretty, as I recall when we've talked about him before.
He's like Palestinian and Syrian or something.
Yeah. So he's like on the non-intervention stuff, he's really solid, but on everything else, I think I recall when we were looking at his record, it's like he's like an open borders libertarian, like just,
no, he's the fucking shittiest libertarian, you know. And before it's like, yeah, okay, you know, I was, anytime more libertarians are getting elected, that's at one point that was something that I was cool with. But you know, if this were today, I'd be like, yeah, he's a fucking dildo on everything else, and his non-interventionist position is essentially ethnic interests, which, you know, I don't disagree with his position, but they're not my ethnic interests.
No. And I mean, it prompted a response from Mitt Romney calling Amash courageous, but the American people just aren't there. And the way that I interpret that is,
yeah,
Amash,
Mitt's fucking sounds just like Nancy Pelosi.
Well, but for different reasons, though, right? I mean, he's trying to keep his powder dry. Like, the whole purpose of Mitt Romney is sort of like John Kasich. I mean, you know, he's going to be a senator. He probably actually wants to run for president in 2024, I'm sure. But if he can before and be the guy to just step in at the right time, that's what he'll do. And he doesn't want to. Amash is sort of like, this is like, you know, sort of jumping the gun here, but I could see Romney jumping on board with something if more came out. I don't know. It just depends on what it is.
Yeah, well, I mean, they're sort of like two peas in a pod, right? Because nobody else was praising Amash, like not even the Freedom Caucus, who he actually helped co-found after he was ushered in as part of the Tea Party wave. So,
well,
you know, aside from Willard out there virtue signaling with him, he's a pretty fucking lonely guy right now.
Well, here's something to consider, though. One reason why, and this is something that the Democrats, you know, sort of criticize the Republicans for all the time, and there is some truth to it, is that there, a lot of them in private feel the same way Amash does. And they'd love to give Amash an attaboy, but they're terrified of what Trump will do to them. And, you know, to a certain extent, Trump will target somebody. I mean, look how he reacted to Amash.
Oh, Amash is looking at a primary.
Oh, yeah.
Which is probably going to be fairly, it's not going to be a joke.
Yeah, so Romney can come out and say that Amash is courageous because he's got fucking 6 years left in the Senate. And, you know, it's whatever. But some of these other people, they're not going to jump ship until it gets really hot. And I don't see that happening anytime soon. So anyway, yeah, there's basically this strategy with the impeachment bit where they're either going to impeach or they're going to slow fuck Trump. And so I think one way or the other, that's going to be whatever shakes out. The next big step has been to get Mueller to testify, which I'm actually looking forward to. But it sounds like Mueller's own team is not wanting him to testify, which is, I don't know, FNARC probably has some good reasons for why that is. I would think that Bob would just fucking be ready to go. But I don't know. Maybe Andrew Weissman doesn't want him to go out there and talk. Maybe they'll send Weissman instead, which would be even better.
Yeah, well, I mean, what I see here is that they seem to be haggling over exactly, you know, what will and will not be for public consumption and so on and so forth. You know, just like the Mueller report. Yeah, I see Premier Jayapal. It's like, oh, I've heard her name twice, not in connection with shilling for illegal immigrants. It's insanity. Yeah, she said the committee should be very careful about restrictions on Mueller's testimony. If it cuts off the ability for us, yeah, if it cuts off our ability to, you know, if we can't just leak it to the press and get right in front of a fucking camera immediately, you know, it does us no good.
Yeah, I just want to, I mean, I'm looking forward to it because I actually want to hear what Mueller has to say. I mean, I you know, I don't know if there will be somebody in those hearings that will ask questions specifically about Trump financial issues, but I'm genuinely interested in those things because I think there's malfeasance there, and especially as it relates to Jared Kushner. And I can, you know, I hope that some of these people like Tlaib or whoever will make sure that these questions get asked. Nobody in the establishment's going to ask those questions, but... Anyway.
Oh yeah, that the subpoena over his financial documents and records is headed to the Washington D.C. Court of Appeals, where a fellow by the name of Merrick Garland spends most of his time. So that could be interesting.
Yeah, I'd love to see where that goes. So yeah, it's just. That's all the stuff on the impeachment back and forth. A lot of that's going to determine, you know, how this election goes. I mean, this blow up though sort of signals that it's going to be a pretty nasty fight. I mean, if Trump, essentially, I don't envision Chuck and Nancy going to the White House again for any reason at all while Trump is president. I mean, why would they? What would be the point? I mean, other than. If the optics were good for them, which I don't know. Although, I don't know, the optics were pretty good for them today, weren't they? I mean...
Yeah, they weren't last time, where Trump, you know, sort of deathly had them come into the Oval with the cameras already rolling and just fucking ambush them. He had a plan and stuck to it.
Yeah.
Yeah, this does not seem like that sort of situation.
The good old days, right? Back when Trump was, we thought Trump was going to own Chuck and Nancy, and now...
I'm not sure what to think about any of these fucking people anymore, dude. Stephen Miller included.
Yeah. Yeah, Miller, I don't know, I don't really know. We'll talk about him here shortly. We talked about him on the weekend show, but there's been some developments on that side as well. Before we get there, this is a good segue. We got some orange faggot news. So Trump... gets Pennsylvania rally to boo Fox News. Something strange is going on. Well, yeah, there's nothing strange about it, Donald. Essentially, the other networks are shitting the bed, and people like Buttplug and Bernie have realized that the place that they're going to get the most number of viewers is Fox News. So I don't see, I mean, and why would Fox turn these people away? I mean, they're making lots of money from these town halls. So it's like, come on, Donald. Like, do you really think that Fox is just going to be like your network? Apparently he does.
Yeah, I don't know. I thought he was talking about sort of more broadly some of the things that have going on at Fox News, which, you know, aside from Tucker, you know, Rod Ailes being gone, Lachlan and his brother, whatever. I mean, something definitely is afoot over there, and it's, you know, it's definitely very shady. But, you know, the reality of that dynamic at Fox News is something that most people in the know have been aware of. I would say that it pales in comparison to the strangeness that now seems to be surrounding your administration.
Yeah, well, in truth, there is something taking place over at Fox News. There has been a shift. I think once Trump is gone, you're going to really see that rapid change take place at Fox, where Fox basically will look like CNN did 5 years ago. It's going to get blacker. It's going to get browner. It's going to get gayer, and it's going to get a lot more anti-white, because after Trump sort of awakened these white nationalist, white supremacist tendencies in the American electorate, Shlomo can't really afford to have Fox News out there as a big mouthpiece. And so, yeah, Tucker's going to be on the chopping block, unfortunately. I don't see any way around that, so... And with
I used to think, could they have them, you know, could they afford to not have Fox News out there doing its, you know, sort of one foot over the line bit? But their plan obviously is to shut everything down on the internet. So, I guess they're just moving forward with it.
They're moving forward with it. I mean, yeah, I agree with you. There was a time when they need Fox News as a pressure release valve. But yeah, you're going to see a rapid change. You're going to see Rush Limbaugh retire probably at the end of Trump's term, because he was planning to retire before Trump became president, and then he decided to stick around to milk those tits for another couple of years. But you're going to see these people disappear. Hannity, I think Hannity is probably, unless Hannity, no, I just don't see Hannity's whole. Like, you're a great American shtick is not going to be compatible with the new Fox world. It's going to be like more Juan Williams and Greg Gutfeld type stuff. And that'll be about as far as it goes. Now, will another new network come in place? I don't know. If it's Trump TV, it's just going to be shitty, dude. It's just going to be like Mark Levin and friends.
CRTV.
Yeah, it's just going to be Mark Levin and friends. It's all going to be kosher. And... they really do want to replace Fox, or not Fox News, but they really do want to replace Tucker with Ben Shapiro. I do buy into that narrative, because that would complete the picture. They need to replace they've already gotten rid of Bill O'Reilly. They've already gotten rid of Greta, who, you know, all these people are going to be gone. Ingram, gone. Hannity, gone. It's just, dude... Tucker gone. They're going to replace them all. It's going to be slow, but I mean, who's surprised by this, right? Like, Paul Ryan's on the board of Fox News now, so it's all about to get very gay.
Yeah, I don't know where Tucker's going to end up. He needs to just go ahead and run for president.
Yeah, he does. That's somebody who I'll unironically support for president for sure if he does it. Other orange faggot news. This is the absolute state of Donald Trump at this point. Trump invites, this is the same Pennsylvania rally where he said something strange is going on at Fox, invites a guy in a wall suit to come up on stage. Look at this guy. We know who he's voting for, Trump said as he shook his hand. The president cited progress on the wall on the southern border. The wall is being built as we speak, Donald said. We will have 500 miles of wall by the end of next year, which is what Miller quote from that interview that he did. I got news for you, Donald. It's from Bloomberg today, top of Drudge. U.S. wall funding of $1.57 billion. Any guesses on how much wall that's built, Halberstam?
Gonna be like 35, 40 miles or so.
You could run it in probably 15 minutes if you're really fucking fast. So, 1.7 miles, guy. That's all the wall that's been built. And I think, what's the top of Drudge? Isn't it Wall Stall? I mean...
that was the headline that accompanying the article. So, yeah, it's not very good. And then Trump is... I guess, came out and said that, yeah, it's basically renovation that's being done. Much of the wall being built at the southern border is a complete demolition and rebuilding of old and worthless barriers with a brand new wall and footings. Problem is, the haters say that it is not new wall, but rather a renovation. Wrong. We must build where most needed. Also, tremendous work is being done on pure renovation, fixing existing walls that are in a bad condition and ineffective. Yeah, okay. So, I mean,
dude,
it's like, well, was there fucking wall there before or not? I don't care if it was knocked down completely and you started over again.
Oh, that's new wall now? Is this like jobs created or saved? This is like wall built or renovated? It's like, oh my God. Yeah, it's so bad. Just President retcon. It really is just a retcon. All of it is just, everything that he does is a retcon. And now what's he going to do with infrastructure now? That's a retcon too. What did he do? I mean, that's, you know, this is the message that we had last week with Stephen Miller. It's like 10 years from now, when people are looking back on the Trump administration, and even the MAGAPEDs, when all the fanfare dies down and reality sets back in, what is the sum total of the accomplishments of Donald Trump? What are they? He didn't protect his supporters. He didn't build any wall. He didn't stop immigration. He's only made it worse. He's actually, immigration has exacerbated under him. We're going to, well, unfortunately, with the direction that the country's going, I would like to say that in the future, we would look back on Donald Trump's presidency and say, wow, those were record numbers coming across the border, but I don't think that those are going to be record-setting figures, unfortunately.
Yeah, I mean, all he really can point to is, his judicial appointments, in particular the Supreme Court, which he's put, you know, two guys who are nothing special, but they're not Elena Kagan and fucking Sotomayor, so that's something, I suppose.
Yeah, well, but unfortunately we're not going to be able to reclaim what is rightfully ours by simply barely holding the line. And this isn't even, I can't even say that this is really holding the line at this point. But yeah, the judicial appointments are the only thing that's going to be, like, 10 years from now, you'll be able to say, oh, there's the legacy of Donald Trump, is a couple of judges that may or may not, likely may not rule in our favor. It's like President Sessions is the guy. He has the legacy on immigration, is Jeff Sessions. And that's about it. I don't really it's so bad. Especially
speaking
of
legacy on immigration. Yeah, do you want to hit this audio RE verify?
Yeah, might as well just do the whole thing. Come on, let's do it.
All right, yeah. So thank you to whoever posted this on my Twitter timeline. It's certainly great audio for the show, but aside from that, it was rather painful to listen to.
People have speculated about was that it might include E-Verify. Is that going to be in the...
So E-Verify is going to be possibly a part of it. The one problem is E-Verify is so tough that in some cases, like farmers, they're not equipped for E-Verify. I mean, I say this against Republicans. A lot of the Republicans say you go through an E-Verify. I used it when I built the hotel down the road on Pennsylvania Avenue. I use a very strong E-Verify system. And we would go through 28 people, 29, 30 people before we found one that qualified.
Right.
So it's a very tough thing to ask a farmer to go through that. So in a certain way, I speak against myself, but you also have to have a world of some practicality.
So when people hear that, some of the people, if you like, who are most they're described as the restrictionists, the people who really want to kind of cut immigration to practically nothing. They hear that and they say, well, this plan was written by Jared Kushner and he's a globalist and it's all letting people in. What do you say to those? Many of them will be your supporters who are nervous about it.
Yeah, Steve, this is not a globalist plan. I wanted this to be very, very strong. You know, we did judicial reform. You saw what we did there and a lot.
Yeah, blah, blah, blah.
This is not a globalist plan. Oh, my God, dude.
It's like, yeah, I don't know. Steve, I guess his name is, sort of articulated my concerns very well.
Yeah, yeah, he really did. I mean, if we're going to call it restrictionist, can we call the other side of the argument globo-homoists? It's like they always come up with great names for you know, it's all propaganda. I mean, the way that they do this, the same thing with you know, anti-abortion and all this stuff, that the way that they frame this. I lost my train of thought with what I was going to say.
Pro-choice.
Yeah,
fucking word games.
Yeah, it's all word games. But yeah, I mean, listen to him talk. Just the stream of consciousness about E-Verify. You know, it's very tough. Well, it was very tough for you to do it, too, at Mar-a-Lago, huh, Donald? Because that's where, you know... Yeah. But really difficult for literally any employer to verify someone's... Yeah,
we do it for people who are actually building stuff and could be touching important stuff, but, you know, groundskeepers and, you know, cleaning staff at Mar-a-Lago, we're not so worried about. But it's like, so anecdotally, you got like one person out of 30 that passed. Seems to me the takeaway should be that this is something that's desperately needed, like yesterday.
Yeah. Yep. And then he goes on to say that it's a matter of practicality. Yes, white people being fucked out of their country. It's impractical to be America first, right? I mean, that's what he's saying. It's an impracticality to give jobs to native-born Americans first and not give them to illegal immigrants. It's great rhetoric, Donald. Really good. Oh, I know I'm speaking against myself. It's like, yeah, maybe you should just shut the fuck up. He should have taken that advice today, too. I'm glad he's not shutting the fuck up, though, because this is great stuff. This is for the Mogipedes have to become detached from this as quickly as possible.
Yeah, and they need to understand that Kushner, Mr. Kushner, the fucking bizarre weirdo that he is the problem. You know, and since that guy asked that, apparently that narrative is getting out there, that concern is making its way, you know, it's at least going through the media, which means eventually he was being interviewed, so hopefully he gets the fucking picture now. It's like, yes, Zognold, that is in fact what people think. He wasn't just shilling you. Let me tell you, that is an accurate perception.
That's what I'm saying. Like, if Stephen Miller really wanted to do some good, it would be to do what Ethnarch said. Quit. Do what Bannon did. Declare Trumpism dead. I mean, we all know that it's dead, but I mean, for all the rubes out there who are still on the bandwagon, declare it dead and write the book on why it was a failure. Write the sequel to Kushner Inc., actually. Because Kushner Inc. only takes us up to like March 2019. We need Stephen Miller to fill in all the blanks that Mike was dissatisfied with in the book, which I agree was dissatisfied with as well. Miller needs to write, you know, give us some more context. But it doesn't appear, I don't know, it doesn't appear that that's going to be the case. This is actually a good segue to what happened with the Kobach immigration czar thing. So right after we did the show on Sunday, then I think it was like Monday. I don't remember when this was sent to me. Maybe it was yesterday. I think it was yesterday when all this went down with Ryan Gudurski. You saw this, right?
Yeah. So, the conversation that I saw,
ooh.
Oh, of course.
Ooh.
Yeah, this...
This tweet has been deleted, my dude. I didn't realize. But that tweet is gone. Gudurski said, four contacts from the administration just texted me, Stephen Miller leaked this. And this is the list of things that Kobach wanted as immigration czar. And I just went to the tweet, and it's gone. Gudurski deleted it. So,
well, there were a whole bunch of other tweets, you know, that I saw and captured yesterday. Of course, it doesn't, the view that I have, unless you click on the tweet itself, it just says, you know, 21 hours ago or whatever. But he further elaborated, saying that only three people had the list, according to his sources: Trump, Miller, and Mulvaney. Both Kobach and Cuccinelli had meetings with Trump, Miller, and Mulvaney, or Trump, Miller, Mulvaney, and the acting DHS secretary 3 weeks ago. Jared was in and out of meetings, but not essential. Certain people in the administration have been gunning for Kobach from the beginning. Miller is one of them, according to several sources. Same reason he went after Lee Francis and did nothing when Darren Beatty was fired. Gunning for all the immigration hawks More coming tomorrow, but Miller has known for a long time if he's the only immigration hawk in the White House, he's essential to the base.
Yeah, but did more ever come from Gudersky? That's the thing. It's like Gudersky's tweet is now gone. Gudersky's Jewish, by the way, but he's someone who has been sort of an immigration hawk himself, at least on Twitter. And, you know, he and Anne, you know, are sort of like peas in a pod. And so, you know, when Gudersky said this, I was like, okay, why would Gudersky throw Miller under the bus? Is Miller really, really, you know, maybe Miller is problematic? And so I, you know, was talking to Ethnarch and talking to some other people and like thinking through this and being like, okay, so let's say for a second that you take everything that Gudersky is saying at face value, that Miller does not want anyone else in the administration who is going to supersede him as immigration hawk. Okay, so he's jealous. He's worried about his position. If he brings Kobach in, then is he afraid that he would not be in charge? It's possible. I mean, that sounds like, you know, something a Jew would sort of do, sort of a natural tendency to be the one guy there. But if Miller sort of has a higher purpose, and he wants to defeat Kushner, if this fight is to be believed, this sort of paradigm that's there, why wouldn't he want more people on his side? Why wouldn't he want another figure there to help him, unless he's not acting in good faith? So I don't really know. The other possibility, if you don't believe that narrative, is that this was a smear perpetrated by Kushner to smear both Kobach and Miller at the same time, and the result was Kobach didn't get selected for the position. Well, if that's true, then Miller has lost another battle, and it's time to go. This is yet another defeat for Miller, unless it's on purpose, and then it's a victory, I guess. I don't know what to believe at this point, but
yeah, I agree with you. Someone asked me my opinion on it, and it's like, well, it seems to me he's either, you know, I would interpret it as potentially he's, you know, trying to control both sides of the debate. The quote-unquote restrictionist position begins and ends with him. If he's above board, he would want, you know, as many capable reinforcements as possible. And then I would ask, you know, what was his take on Kobach versus Cuccinelli? And why do we have Cuccinelli now?
Yeah, well, I mean, that's the thing. And this is what I sort of speculated to you when we were talking on the phone, is that if your goal as Donald Trump is to look tough on immigration, but ultimately not accomplish anything, right? Like playing the game that his kids don't know how to play, then you pick Ken Cuccinelli. Because in Trump's calculation, he's a Tea Party guy. He's popular with the base. He's a conservative. But ultimately, he's going to fail in terms of accomplishing the goals, whereas Kris Kobach is a guy who is sincere, who is genuine, who wants to get the job done, like Jeff Sessions, and that's not who you want in the position. All this bullshit about Kris Kobach wanting a jet and all this other, it's just garbage. Like, those are legitimate requests anyway.
Well, I do believe he wanted basically unrestricted access to the president, because I imagine his philosophy was, you know, because it's not like, I'm not the right person for the job if you're just doing this for show. And if you're doing this for show, you know, this is not the right outfit for me. You know, sort of like the conversation we were having about Mr. Miller. It's like, what kind of future does he really envision for himself? But, you know, it's like, if I'm going to do this, I'm doing it all the way. I'm not going to come in and just get involved in all this fucking cheese dickery that does nothing but ultimately sully my name.
It is cheese dickery. I mean, one thing about Kobach's list of demands, though, I could see Miller maybe having a problem with, and it's one and one only. It's that if it's true that this is even an authentic list from Kobach. But one of the things on there was that he wanted to be the sole spokesman on immigration, on everything, in the media, everywhere. And that actually probably would have not sat well with Jared Kushner either, but also with Miller. And it actually doesn't sit well with me, because Miller, I don't know, Kobach, you know, he's got a good good track record on you know, sort of being a technocrat, but I mean, dude.
Yeah, no. Miller's obviously ready to fucking throw down when he walks into these interviews. Like very few people in Washington are.
Yeah, like if you watch the Chris Wallace Stephen Miller interview or the Stephen Miller Acosta debate, I mean, he's the guy that if he's acting in good faith, he's the guy that you want going to bat for you. So, yeah, so I'm not really sure what to make of this. I mean, all I can say is this. The more battles that Stephen Miller loses like this, and the longer he sticks around and puts up with shit like the Kushner immigration plan, the more inclined I'm to believe that he's complicit in all of that. That cheese dickery, as you called it. Because there's no other good explanation. He's not going to be able to stick around through the total unmitigated failure that Trump's administration has been, and then at the end of the day be able to say, oh, we did all this great stuff. It's like, no you didn't.
Yeah, eventually he needs to just go. I mean, certainly threaten first, be like, look, I'm leaving, I'm not gonna be super quiet after a certain period of time. Oh, and by the way, the source of your remaining credibility and legitimacy, what's left of it on immigration, emanates completely from me. It's not your fucking faggot stepson or fucking son-in-law.
Yeah, it. I mean, that's the reality of it. And then the you know, the more sort of the other side of the coin is that it's being done on purpose. I mean, that's obviously the easy thing to believe, you know, because Miller's Jewish, but I don't really. I mean, if that is what he's doing, the only, you know, it's a tough thing. I'm sort of like split, because it's like, if he really is doing that, like, why would he go through all this trouble to why wouldn't you just leave Christian Nielsen in place? Why wouldn't you just, plus it's, you know?
Yeah, well, it's sort of like the pre-Trump GOP establishment. Like, if the Democrats were smart, you know, they would have given them some wins so that they didn't end up with Trump, and they just could have kept doing the bit with Paul Ryan. Because Miller, because it's always Kushner winning, if that's the bit here, that this is a kosher sandwich, it's getting to be rather an unconvincing one.
Yeah, well, and that's why I go back to this whole part about when Trump comes out and says, you know, it's impractical to do E-Verify. His base needs to hear that. And I'm actually thankful that, you know, Trump sort of just spills, this shit spills out of his mouth, because it's like, now you don't have to wonder what he thinks. Now you don't have to work that hard to sell MAGAPEDs that this guy is just totally bullshit. It's like, do you really think?
It's too tough. It's too tough to do. It's like, I cannot do a good Trump impersonation. I don't know. I have in mind what it should sound like, and that's not how it comes up. But it's like, yeah, it's too tough. I got to tell you, we had a lot of fucking illegal immigrants in this country.
Yeah. Yeah, it's, you have to be really good at speaking in incomplete sentences with incomplete thoughts and just going on and on forever. I mean, that's the only way you can do a real good Trump impression. And besides, like, you know, what good is it to do a good Trump impression these days? I mean, only to make fun of him, I guess. I mean, long gone are the days where, you know, huge and all those memes are even funny anymore. It's just garbage. So anyway,
no, I keep those memes around because they're like, you know, historical artifacts, but yes. I never open the folder.
No, never open the folder. Yeah, you don't want to. Anyway, we're about an hour. Why don't we go to this week's Albion Dispatches, and we'll be right back on the other side of the break right here on Fascination.
You're listening to the show that changed your weekend forever. Fash the Nation. Fash the Nation.
This is Atlas, and these are the Albion Dispatches, collected by Alfred the Average, documenting the oppression of native Britons by a hostile elite and its vibrant clients in the epicenter of clan world. The European Parliament elections are coming up hot and heavy. Nigel's Brexit Party is polling at 38%. This represents a 21-point lead over the Labour Party, who are on 17% in the opinion poll, with the Liberal Democrats third on 15%. Meanwhile, the Conservatives are on 12%, with the Greens on 7%. A different YouGov poll had the Tories at 7%. With the EP elections being proportional representation, the polls are likely to play out, although stunning and brave lefty milkshake protests aren't doing Nigel much harm. As much as things are looking up for Nigel, they're looking pretty grim for May. Brexiteer Tories have come out against her plan to allow MPs to vote on a second referendum if they pass her EU-approved treaty, with some calling for her ousting. The withdrawal agreement bill is set to be voted on for a fourth time next month, and what was touted as a bold offer of concessions to win over Tory Remainers and the opposition was branded as dead on arrival by Marc Francois, vice chairman of the pro-Brexit European Research Group. So what's in this new bill that's even worse than before? Number one, a promise to try to find alternative arrangements designed to keep the Northern Ireland border open. This falls far short of the demands of Tory Brexiteers, who want the backstop dropped entirely. Number two, keeping Northern Ireland's laws tied to Britain's as a pitch to the Democratic Unionist Party, which wants to limit, or stop entirely, divergence between the province and the mainland. Number three, any future trading arrangement with the EU will have to be negotiated and approved for by the Parliament. Number four, keeping EU employment rules and adopting new ones passed by Brussels as a concession to Labour's demands. Tory MPs don't like this because it could actually help workers. Number five, preserving EU green rules. Another offer to Labour that there will be no change in environmental protection after Brexit and new green regulator. Not enough for Labour and too much for the Tories. Number six, a pledge to keep trade barriers as low as possible while leaving the single market and ending free movement. Number seven, following EU goods and agriculture rules. Again, alienating Tory Brexiteers. Number 8, a choice between May's proposal, which has many elements of a customs union but allows for trade deals, and a full customs union until the next election. Number 9, the withdrawal bill will allow for a vote on a second national poll. This is a big no for Brexiteers. Number 10, a commitment to make changes to the political declaration, part of the deal with the EU, to make this offer a reality. May would then go back to the EU. Tory Brexiteer Owen Paterson criticised the amended bill, saying that May had managed to make the bad withdrawal agreement worse, and called it a direct insult to the 17.4 million people who voted to leave in the referendum. Chairman of the ERG, Jacob Rees-Mogg, echoed Paterson's sentiments that the Prime Minister's latest proposals are worse than before, and called for a no-deal WTO exit. Brexiteer Nadine Dorries called it an utter betrayal of all we promised to deliver, with Andrea Jenkins branding it a farcical demonstration of how not to deliver Brexit. While MPs have rejected en masse the bill, which is most certainly likely to fail, a number have been vocal in calling for a new Prime Minister, with Mr. Paterson saying, "Even when it is defeated, we need a new PM and Cabinet determined to leave the EU by 31st of October at the latest." May survived a confidence vote in December, and current party rules mean the Prime Minister is protected from another leadership challenge until December 2019. However, members of the Backbench 1922 Committee are working to see if rules can be changed. Let's wait and see if this is all a load of hot air, or if Tory MPs will finally rediscover their testicles and ditch the Wicked Witch of Westminster. The base Muslims of Britain are still at loggerheads with Globo Homo. Police are investigating claims that LGBT activists were harassed, intimidated, and pelted with eggs outside a primary school in Birmingham, where a row has blown up between the activists and Muslim parents over the teaching of LGBT issues to children. Officers are currently looking into three reports of assault and two of criminal damage after the parents and protesters clashed with the LGBT activists, who were placing banners reading "Love is the Answer" and rainbow flags on the school gates. The group of potentially STD-riddled LGBT activists, which consisted of 12 women and one man, said they were harassed and intimidated by the parents and anti-LGBT protesters. One woman said she was called a vandal for placing the flags and banners on the school gates, and a mobile phone recording reportedly hears one of the parents say, "The people want to come to our area and cause anarchy. I have to hold all the lads back because everyone is becoming very volatile." The school, Anderton Park Primary, is at the centre of a standoff between LGBT activists and predominantly Muslim parents over the teaching of issues such as gay relationships and gender identity at the school. Protesters claim that up to 600 children were withdrawn from classes by their parents over the decision. At least the third world hordes are good for something. More of this, please. News for this edition of Albion Dispatches was sourced from Breitbart London, Westminster, The Morning Star, and mainstream UK media sources. Tune into Albion Dispatches in 2 weeks, heard only on Fash the Nation at therightstuff.biz.
And now, back to Fash the Nation, heard only on the TRS Radio Network.
And we are back. Thank you to Atlas and Alfred the Average for this week's installment of Albion Dispatches. So with everything going on, it was it could have been easy to miss. This one almost slipped by. There was actually an election, and we do have some results. Pennsylvania's 12th district stays red after Tom Marino's surprise resignation. Republican State Representative Fred Keller won Pennsylvania's 12th district congressional special election Tuesday night, ensuring that the district stays in Republican hands. He took 70.3% of the vote. That was what was the tally, with 64% of precincts reporting when this article was published. Well, his Democratic opponent, Mark Friedenberg, took only 29.9%, according to the New York Times. President Trump had held a rally in Montoursville on Monday to energize voters the night before the general election. Mr. Keller has represented voters from central Pennsylvania in the state house since 2010, according to Ballotopedia. He will be one of only two members of Congress who never attended college, according to 538 elections analyst Nathaniel Rakich, who wrote on Twitter.
Who's the other? Says why I'm who's the other person who didn't finish or who didn't go to college? Is it Dave Bratt or somebody like that?
I don't know. I wouldn't imagine it was Dave. But wasn't he like a professor?
Oh, maybe. Maybe. I don't really know. I just, I remember.
Yeah,
I'd
be curious to know whether that person is, you know, an actual white person who didn't go to college, or just, you know, one of the other, in which case, who the fuck cares?
Yeah. Well, in this case, it's a white guy who, I guess, was, you said he was ran a wood business or something?
Yeah, well, I guess it seems like probably a fairly large operation, a woodworking outfit, you know, where this guy lived in central PA. Started there right out of high school, ended up running the place.
So you think he'd be good at assembling a bundle of faggots into a fascies?
I think he probably could do that with his eyes closed.
He's got some skill doing that? Yeah, and in reality, I don't know anything about this guy, but I hear...
No, I'm not saying he's our guy or
no,
anything.
No, no, not
but
at all.
He does seem like a more salt-of-the-earth type fellow who never went to college and then beat this Jew. So, something to be said for that.
Yeah,
of course it is.
Go ahead.
I was going to say, of course, it is central Pennsylvania.
Yeah, that was the dismaying thing about it, was that... That's who was on the other. When you look at this district, it's extremely rural. But I mean, they were trying to run Friedenberg in that district. So, oh man,
yeah. What did they say about Pennsylvania? You got Philadelphia, Pittsburgh, and Alabama in between, or Pennsylvania is the other one.
Something like that. Yeah, yeah. Well, we were talking before we in the prep that. You know, what's important about this race? Because you're like, I got the 12th district here. What else should we talk about? And I was like, yeah, well, what is important about this? You know, because I've increasingly just, you know, become sort of jaded about the whole political process.
GOP win. Woo.
Yeah, great. Yay. You know, and it's like, what's the rub here? But then, you know, you and I started scratching below the surface on this race. And, you know, even though this is in no way a benefit to any of us, it is in some way, and who knows what could end up with this, what could happen with this guy, who knows? But the point is that this is a district that was redrawn as a result of the Pennsylvania Supreme Court ordering the redrawing of the state congressional map. And it forced the special election was forced, of course, by Tom Marino's surprise resignation that he says is about health issues. But usually that, and maybe he does have health issues, but usually that's a cover for some other sort of embarrassment. And so started to dig into this a little bit.
Yeah. You don't really say health issues. You just say, like, I have cancer. I need to go so that maybe I can live.
Yeah. Yeah. That's all. Yeah. Well, I mean, I wouldn't wish this on anybody, but when you see this guy's track record, so digging back into Tom Marino a little bit, he, on September 1st, 2017, Trump nominated Marino to be the director of the Office of National drug control policy, otherwise known as the ONDCP. This is a position that is commonly known as the drug czar. Now, this would have otherwise been somewhat of an inconsequential appointment. And this just sort of illustrates how sort of, you know, when people want to make the case that Donald Trump's administration is, you know, very, very well put together and very, you know, in terms of like thinking strategy through very completely. This is a guy who withdrew his nomination. I had forgotten about this. On October 17th, which would be, what is the math on that? 46 days later, following reports that he had been the chief architect behind a bill that protected pharmaceutical manufacturers and distributors and crippled the DEA's ability to combat the U.S. opioid epidemic. So this guy was a Sackler shill that Trump was naming as his drug czar. Now, maybe that was by design, because he then he announced his resignation when everything became public. So, yeah, I just think this guy has been embattled for a while, and I don't think it has anything to do with his health issues. I think he just, you know, it was like, time to go, guy. People were digging a little too deep.
Yeah, and that's exactly what the ONDCP certainly should be doing now. It's what they should have been doing all along. You know, I was just thinking about when was the last time that I saw, you know, one of those commercials, because you used to see them all the time. But it was like, I don't know, it was always pointless. It was like, yeah, you know, you shouldn't smoke crack. It's like, okay, buddy, I got you.
Yeah, well, and the commercials are all like, yeah, I mean, that's the one with the egg in the pan, I think. But like all the commercials that I ever recall with the ONDCP are always like portraying like white people doing like drugs and degenerate stuff. Like you were saying, there was one where they were like a bunch of white kids were like in a car getting high at like a drive-through line or something like that, right?
Yeah, and then, you know, they're all high and laughing it up, and they go to pull away, and a little girl on a bicycle who is obscured, you know, by the fast food restaurant drives out in front of their car, and blah, 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 blah. Of course, in this particular arena, like, I don't mind everybody being white. Like, I sort of want, it's like, yeah, I want, like, white people to get that message, like, the message that, you know, like I was saying, like, the message that black people shouldn't smoke crack and shit. It's like, yeah, okay. Nobody cares.
That is true. I was thinking about that, and it is true. So maybe this is why. Because here's the other thing. So not only did the Trump administration nominate this Marino guy. By the way, this law that he tried to introduce was called the Ensuring Patient Access and Effective Drug Enforcement Act, which, you know, typically it's like the opposite of what it says it's going to do.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. This is definitely one of those instances. One of those instances. It's literally was intended to hamstring enforcement actions against these companies.
Well, yeah. Well, in ensuring patient access, that was the one true part about it, is ensuring patient access. It's like, we want to give people lots of drugs and prevent any of these corporations from being prosecuted for doing it. And oh, by the way.
Yeah. Or doctors. Because it's the DEA that hits them up, right?
Yeah, well, the doctors are the street-level sales guys. I mean, that's how that works. And what's interesting about this is that...
How'd you like a trip to Cancun?
To get some injections, yeah. Yeah, dude, I didn't realize this, but Marino introduced this bill two times, in 2014 and again in 2015. So this would have been, I mean, the opiate crisis was like well underway at that point, but it hadn't hit the crescendo that it has now. So imagine like passing, like these people are already raking in the cash. And here you have Marino out there doing the bit like even harder, of course. And so the 2014 version was opposed both by the DEA and the Justice Department. The 2015 version was sold as an attempt to, quote, work with pharmaceutical companies and was subject to heavy lobbying. It's like, oh, my God.
It doesn't surprise me that he introduced it twice. It's like, yeah, here, you know, we'll throw you some shekels. We need to introduce this bill. And then, you know, as events progressed, you know, sort of toward what we're seeing today, I'm sure they went back and were like, yo, you really need to introduce this bill.
Well, guess who else introduced a Senate version of the bill? None other than another person who is no longer in Congress, Orrin Hatch. He introduced a similar version in the Senate, passed by both houses of Congress by unanimous consent, and was signed into law by Obama in 2016. The legislation aimed to weaken the DEA's authority. See, this is the thing. Marino was doing bad optics. Orrin Hatch was like, yo, guy, I'm an old hand at this. Let me get it done. Let me get it done for you. And not only did it get passed unanimously, Obama signed it into law. So the legislation aimed to weaken DEA's authority to take enforcement action against drug distributors who supplied unscrupulous physician and pharmacists with opioids for diversion to the black market. Previously, the DEA had fined individuals who profited on suspicious sales of painkillers and repeatedly ignored warnings that painkillers were sold illegally. The new legislation made it virtually impossible for the DEA to stop these sales, according to internal agency documents. Justice Department documents and DEA Chief Administrative Law Judge John J. Mulrooney II did not comment on the reports. So,
well, that's how you ended up with these, you know, pill mills in places in Appalachia. If you just took one look at the numbers, it's like, well, either something's not right here, or, you know, everyone in the surrounding, like, three counties is just, like, on OxyContin at all times.
Yeah, well, and the problem was already bad, and they come out and pass this bill. It's like, guys, come on, like, we need to make this problem even worse. So everybody that gave unanimous consent on this bill, and Obama, and Orrin Hatch, and Marina, all these people are guilty of making this problem worse. Why isn't anybody talking about it? I wonder why Donald Trump takes the guy that failed at getting this bill done and makes him the drug czar of his administration. I wonder.
Oh, man. Yeah, I don't know. It's like, I don't... It's this has been a very blackpilling week for me. Like, I was just it sort of all hit me at once as I was sort of consuming everything in the prep right before we started. It's just like, dude, this is so fucking bad.
It's really bad. Well, like I've been saying the last couple episodes, I mean, we've made a strong departure from supporting the president when it became clear that there was just no possible way that any of this could be in good faith. You know, you were willing to go along with it because, you know, the odds that the guy was up against. But it just seems it's like no longer a mistake at this point, like especially with that E-Verify audio. But I mean, at this point for me, it's like I'm entertained by how clownish it is going to become. And it continues to just unfold in this way. So, yeah, this race, you know, if it weren't for this race in Pennsylvania and being like, give me a reason to care about this, I wouldn't have gone back to look into this. I had forgotten that Marino was made the drug czar. I remembered that the guy Trump made his drug czar withdrew his nomination because he was involved in shit like this. But, I mean, oh my God, dude. Just so bad. Just so bad.
Yeah, when you see it sort of all coming together, you know, in all these facets all at once, and then yeah, that E-Verify audio about, you know, oh, it's so tough. It's just the icing on the cake. But yeah, I mean, he'll continue to drive the news cycle and drive the Democrats insane. And as I've been saying, we've been putting forward for a while now that we said that may well be ultimately the only utility that Trump has left, and it would seem that we're nigh upon that point.
It looks like they're driving him insane. I mean, based on what happened
well, today, that's what it looked like. Yeah,
yeah. I mean, they're really driving him insane. It's like Nancy and Chuck seem to like have their shit together, and I've had the feeling for a while that, you know, there was a period of chaos, and you can sort of look at this in, you know, with hindsight 2020. But in, you know, starting with election night, when the reality set in that, whoa, this guy won and we can't stop him, and all the way up until really, I don't know, when Mueller decided not to prosecute him, it was it was like Mueller, that was the bookend of where this process got brought back under control. And it might have been before that, that it happened. But for a while there was chaos. They didn't know how to control this. This was, guy was not supposed to win. This is not part of their plan. But they've sort of dialed this back in. You have influx of non-white immigration is ramped back up. The only thing that they haven't been able to do is get another war started. They've failed at every turn. And Jesse was sort of wondering out loud on Monday, like, why they haven't been able to do that. And it's just, I mean, I don't really have a good answer for it. I mean, I know why they haven't been able to do it, but like, what's the real reason that they haven't, you know, because if these people want something to happen, they'll make it happen. But what's the reason they can't get a war with Iran? What's the reason that they can't get Venezuela working? What's the reason that Assad is still alive? I don't really know the answer. Other than they are afraid that they can't sell these bodies coming home from this shit anymore. And,
yeah, well, maybe they should have, you know, shouldn't have gone so hard against George W. Bush. I mean, that just elevated, you know, sort of the anti-war sentiment, and the fact that there were no WMD, you know, and also I'm sure Republicans took note of, you know, I'm sure George W. Bush is not, you know, he's going to live a very nice rest of his days, but his exit was pretty unceremonious. And the, you know, the state that the GOP was left in as a reason. I mean, yeah, Bush was shitty on a lot of things, but that was ultimately, you know, what made his administration untouchable. And so, yeah, maybe they should not have gone as hard as they did on him. But I don't know. It's people just don't want another. You know, I think that's what probably Donald Trump thinks about. It's like, look, I'm not going to be that guy. Like, you know, I'll fire a few cruise missiles and shit, but we're not doing that.
Yeah, but I mean, here's the shitty thing, though, is if they knew that they could sell a war to the American public, Assad would be dead. Trump would be all about tearing down Iran and everything else. If it made him look good. If it had like that gold flake, you know, gilded crust that Donald likes putting all over everything that's his brand, he would be all over it. I mean, he would love it.
Yeah, if it was just going to be, you know, essentially a year of the adulation that he received after that Tomahawk strike on Syria, which was, you know, even Tulsi Gabbard talked about that in her anti-neocon ad that she put out.
Yeah. Yeah, Trump got a lot of upcom. Remember all the upcomings that he got from the international community for that?
It was the only. Yeah, I mean, I'm sure he remembers that like 36 hours very fondly.
Yeah, he's like, one of my shit posts went viral. It's like, oh man, one more thing about this this ONDCP before I forget. If you're still questioning sort of this narrative that, you know, maybe Donald Trump, he doesn't care about actually stopping the opioid crisis. It isn't that he can't do anything about it. It's that he doesn't want to do anything about it. It's that he almost made one of his drug czars one of these guys that had an interest in not doing anything about it. In fact, tried to pass legislation. And then was succeeded by Orrin Hatch, who's curiously no longer in Congress. It's like usually these guys stay in until they're dead. And all of a sudden, Orrin Hatch is like, I quit. You know, and of course, that was probably to like let Mitt come in. That's like the one exception. You know, I'll step down so you can step up. You know, this is good for the establishment in the long run. But I was looking into this when we were talking about the 12th district race, and ONDCP in its $2.5 billion in funding was a program that the Trump administration wanted to eliminate. They wanted to get rid of the educational program of telling people not to use drugs. So, I mean, you could make the argument that those programs don't make a lick of difference and that, you know, the whole thing is just a fucking stroke job or whatever. And maybe that argument has some merit to it, but
I mean, it was really bad. Like, just say no. Like, if they could have just, you know, they should have just been like, you know, so you want to end up like this fucking junkie, you want to live your life like a non-white person, then fucking don't do this shit.
You know who they should make the drug czar of the Office of National Drug Control Policy? If they were going to actually do a damn thing about it, is Duterte. Put Duterte in charge. That's what we need to control drug use in the United States. Not commercials. Not garbage like this. They need actual physical punishment for drug dealers, drug cartels, and everything else. But no! Instead, the Congress votes unanimously to make it harder to prosecute people who are supplying the black market with drugs. So, yeah, that's it, you know?
And life in society will be impossible unless you shoot these people with Uzis.
Yeah. Life is becoming more and more impossible with each passing day. I mean, look at this. It's just so disgusting. Well, and that's the other thing about Tom Marino's district is if you look at it, it's basically central PA. I mean, how many people have died in his district as a result of these policies? And this guy is representing them. And, you know, I bet I could find a whole bunch of quotes on Tom Marino being pro-Israel, too. I mean, this is just ridiculous.
I'm trying to remember what the guy looked like. I think he was shitty-looking fellow.
Yeah, oh, yeah, here we go. Office of the Clerk for Tom Marino, 116th Congress. Where the hell did this go? Yeah. Republican Marino slams Obama administration's refusal to back Israel. There you go.
Oh, yeah.
Let's talk about something important.
Yep. So, Democrats. I'll let you take the lead on this because I'm not prepped on this at all. But California Democrats' health care for illegal immigrants debate is underway. This has got to be just a fucking stroke job because they're not doing single payer health care in California because of illegal immigrants. So now they're having the debate on whether or not to cover them. It's like with what? Like monopoly money?
Yeah, well, I think that's the point that Gavin Newsom he needs to come in and be the white savior and sort of explain all this. That was my takeaway from this National Review article. Yeah. Gavin Newsom presented a budget proposal this week that calls for $98 million in new spending to make all low-income illegal immigrants ages 19 to 26 eligible for the Medi-Cal program. So it would, you know, cover that group of people in a similar manner as Obamacare. Meanwhile, Democrats in the state assembly have introduced a bill that would cover all illegal immigrants over the age of 19 at a cost of $3.4 billion. A third bill introduced by Democrats in the state Senate would cover all legal immigrants aged 19 to 26, as well as those 65 and over. So we got them on Obamacare and Medicare, effectively. Proponents of a more expansive public option for illegal immigrants have argued that Sacramento can accommodate the larger price tag due to the state's projected $21.5 billion budget surplus for the year.
No,
okay.
You know what I just realized? This cost of insuring these illegal immigrants of $3.4 billion, you know, it also costs $3.4 billion. You'll never guess what.
A wall?
No, the money that Gavin took from the federal government that he was supposed to spend on a train that he's not giving back to the federal government. So they're going to spend it on illegal immigrants instead. It's like, yeah, we have the money to do this now, you guys. Like, Trump's a pussy. He's not going to get the money back. So let's make it rain. Yeah, it was just looking at this. It's like $3.4 billion. It's like, yeah, we got it covered. And Gavin can pay himself a $100 million bonus on top of it, I'm sure. Just political favors for whoever.
Yeah, for a few years it'll probably work. They work in our hotels. They work picking the fruit and vegetables. They work as landscapers. They work in hospitals, said State Senator Maria Elena Durazo, a L.A. Democrat who authored the more expansive Senate bill. I don't think they should be treated differently from other Californians. I'm sure you fucking don't. Newsom, however, has argued that expanding the eligible pool to immigrants over 25 would introduce new costs that might overwhelm the system in the event of an economic slowdown. There's old Whitey thinking a little bit.
Yeah, just a little bit, just a skosh. Yeah, it's so bad. Yeah, the debate over this stuff is hilarious. And yeah, I guess the state of California is suing the Trump administration for the first $1 billion. They'll probably win, too, for the train. I lost the news story. I have no idea where it went at this point. But essentially, that's what's happening. Oh, yeah, there we go. California sues Trump to keep $1 billion. So Trump asked for the $3.5 billion back. So there's two sort of tranches of money. Trump canceled $1 billion that hadn't been given to California yet. And then it went further to ask for the three and a half that they had already received back. And so now California is suing the Trump administration over that $1 billion that was canceled. And they're probably going to get it. I'm sure that there is some judge somewhere that, you know, they're going to shop for the right judicial forum for this. But I bet that they will get that $1 billion. So, you know, more money for illegal health care, I guess.
Yeah, I'm not really familiar with any sort of precedent on that. You know, a state suing the government for money that was promised, but for a project that had turned into an obvious, complete, and total fucking boondoggle.
Yeah, if we had an unclownish world, I mean, any judge would look at that lawsuit and be like, okay, Gavin, can you, like, show us the train or the tracks or the route or the end date or something? What are you suing to get $1 billion for, guy? And maybe you should give back the $3.5 billion now that we're talking about it, because you didn't fucking build anything.
Yeah, no. I mean, the reality of the situation with the train is laughable, and it, you know, as we've talked about, it doesn't even go anywhere. It goes from somewhere in McCarthy's district to some other fucking nowhere farm town.
Yeah, yeah. No, all it is basically migrant. It's a migrant rapid migrant delivery service is what it is. I don't know why Gavin wouldn't want this, but I guess the cartels came in with a lower bid.
Yeah, not to be confused with its predecessor, the Underground Rapid Dindu Delivery System.
Yeah, yeah. Weren't we talking about something recently about the Underground Railroad? I think it was you and me were talking about this when we were saying that that it's possible that some of the people who are sort of participants in the Underground Railroad and, you know, whatever, it's like, part of that was predicated on the idea that, like, they would just keep going. Like, come on, you know, just run. I think you said run and just never stop running.
Yeah, don't look back.
Yeah, because it's like
it's like a lot of the resistance to slavery was people just didn't want fucking blacks everywhere, you know. And this is completely ignored. You know, the long arc of history muddies the water so much. Yeah, it went right from emancipation to, you know, everyone was like, I want these people going to school with my kids, like then and there.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and a lot of the abolition stuff was about, like, it was also
dude, if you had told any of these people that fucking blacks were going to be going to school with their children, any of them, even the hardcore abolitionists, if you had told the fucking people, the guys in the Union Army that, they would have met the Army of Northern Virginia somewhere outside Washington, and they would have fucking just burned it and smoked everybody together.
Yeah, well. If only someone could go back and tell them just how bad it really has gotten. Even you don't even have to go back that far. You just go back to World War II and just be like, guys, hey guys, not your fight. Don't do that. You might even want to, like, go pick out some German army uniforms while you're over there, because this is not what anybody wants. But yeah, this notion of the Underground Railroad, it's like, well, why did the Underground Railroad extend so far into the north? It's like, wouldn't they just be safe as soon as they got across the Mason-Dixon line? And it's like, no, dude, these people
wouldn't
wanted
they have
them
been
going
cool in Vermont.
Yeah, like, well, what? They wanted them to go all the way to fucking Canada. It's like, just get out of here. Like you said, keep on running and never look back. That's so good. Yeah, because there was a lot of sympathy with a lot of these, you know, border states, because especially if you were a border state along the rivers that drained into the Mississippi, it's like a lot of the states that were in the north, geographically in the north, depended solely on downriver markets to sell their goods and wares. And it's like, why are we going to war with the people who are going to buy our shit and stuff? It's like, what? Why the fuck would we do that? And, you know, there was a lot of sympathy to that whole effect. And, yeah, I mean, they didn't really appreciate the blacks either. But anyway, before we go too far afield, we got to get Ethnarch working on that Lincoln the Man outline. We got to finish this thing so we can go deeper onto some of these subjects. But anyway, how do we get there?
Yeah.
We were talking about the underground,
the train.
yeah. Oh man, well.
So, I don't know. Apparently, according to Salon, and I saw this cited a number of other places, Joe Biden and Bernie Sanders are locked in a dead heat in a crucial Iowa poll that is, for now, a one-off, and also one that I haven't heard before. But if it seems to be some sort of local Iowa polling outfit, and this is their time to shine. So if that's the case, then they probably know something. An Iowa starting line change research poll finds that 24% of likely Democratic caucus goers support Biden and another 24% support Sanders. Mayor Buttplug comes in at 14%, followed by Elizabeth Warren at 12%. She has actually been rising in the polls a little bit. That's a real thing. Harris at 10 and Beto at 5%. Beto's still doing all right in Iowa, better than Cory Booker. Imagine that.
Yeah. Cory Booker. I mean, see, this is some of these people are just going to drop out. Oh, they're going to be encouraged to drop out too, because it's sort of a fait accompli at this point for a lot of them. I mean, it's like, why would you stay in the race and suck up dollars and suck up seats on the debate stage? And, you know, I think after that first debate, I think you're going to see an appetite for culling of the Democratic field, because people are going to be angry that their person didn't get a chance to speak very much.
It's like you made a little bit of money, you know, make sure just get out of debt and get out. You've burnished your resume a little bit. You can now add former presidential candidate to that. Now hit the fucking road, pal.
Yeah. Well, I was thinking about this too. I have sort of a hot take, we didn't get to this on Saturday, but the reason why, cause I've been thinking a lot about this, and I know you and I talked about this on the midweek show last week about the reason why there are so many people in the field. And the one thing, and Ethnarch pointed this out, is that if you notice, all the new people that are joining the race who seemingly have no purpose being there, like Bullock and de Blasio and whoever, Hickenlooper and fucking Inslee and all this shit, what do they all have in common? They're white. Why aren't there any more non-whites getting in the race? Like, if the strategy is to sort of, you know, synthesize excitement in the Democratic side and then everybody just get in line behind the nominee, why not have people who look like the Browning Democratic Party? Well, the reason is because what they're trying to do is synthesize. They're not trying to synthesize excitement. They're trying to synthesize whiteness and get people, you know, because they need to convince white voters to still come out to the polls for Biden, right? And if the plan is to make Biden the nominee or butt plug on the ticket with him or whatever, it's going to be a white ticket. They also have to encourage those white voters to come out and vote. And I think one of the things that they're doing by having all these white candidates in the race is to sort of make it seem like the Democratic Party isn't turning brown and looking like a shit show. They're trying to sort of meme the idea that there are all these like upstanding, you know, white guys like still in it. It's still a very white party. I don't know what that does for the sort of the non-white constituents. I think we're going to call them what, big black and big brown now.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I don't know. To them, it's like all these guys look like all the presidents of the United States, you know, prior to Obama. It'll be sort of nothing different to them. It'll, in a sense, be sort of reaffirming their views. But Yeah, I mean, if you're just looking at the people on the stage, you'll get the impression that the Democratic Party is not, you know, in control of Browns, and that's the future. But then you see these other articles, you know, talking about Biden and his strength with minorities and how, you know, if that doesn't change, this thing's in the bag. Because those people, like, they do, you hear some of these people, you know, admit that these people control Democratic primary politics
at
this point. And that's a very bad position to be in as a political party. Never mind the fact that, you know, they're anti-white and they hate you. Just it's like, ooh, brown people are basically dictating every course of action for this political organization. Never mind the fact that these people want to see you dead. Like, it's worth jumping ship over that alone.
Yeah, well, and that actually bolsters my theory, because if they don't have to worry about getting support from non-whites, like if Biden already has minorities in the bag just because, and he doesn't have any issues with things that he said in the past aren't posing a problem for him, then he doesn't have to worry about convincing those voters. They just have to worry about turning those voters out. Like, they already have the support. It's about, like, waving the chicken wang in the face and getting them to come out to the polls on election day. So then the problem becomes is, how does Biden convince the white Obama voter turned Trump voter to come back to the Democratic side? And the key there is to sort of make the Democratic Party seem like it isn't turning into a fucking Star Wars bar scene, but the reality is that it is. I mean, look at the polling on all these other white guys that are in the race other than Biden. It's not great, and that's not going to bode well for the future, because I don't know how well that's going to work. I mean, Buttplug can't get the non-white vote. Buttplug will not get support from Big Black. He's not going to get it.
There's a couple butt plug articles that we have if we get time to do so, but I'm just going to go ahead and play this right now.
Go ahead.
Interesting conversations and challenging ones. Mm-hmm. When I took him to Harlem, the Sylvia's, it was to say, even in the middle of the African-American community, which does have a lot of people that are homophobic, we wanted to say that here's a major candidate who's openly gay and that he should be given the hearing and respect like anyone else.
Yeah, so there you have it, folks.
Yeah, well, I mean, I don't get is Sharpton doing, like, the Congressional Black Caucus, like, bit here that he should be heard? They're trying to normalize him or what?
Yeah, well, I mean, Sharpton probably is cognizant of the fact that there's gonna, you know, these issues are gonna be boiling up down the road, and it's probably not gonna work, but you at least have to try to forge some sort of alliance with the, you know, Big Gay, which is not actually that big. It's mostly supported, but it does have a lot of Hollywood money, which we made note of. Buttigieg was out there collecting in Kamala Harris territory, doing very well for himself too. So I don't know. Plus he doesn't, you know, he doesn't want, these white shit libs to start, because this is something that's very important to them. Like, so are black people, but it's like, I don't know. Do you really want to put them to a choice?
Yeah. Yeah. And I see some of the normalization there, because Buttplug and Biden, I mean, Buttplug is a good, compliment of Biden in terms of his age, in terms of his high verbal IQ, because Buttplug, I mean, if you just look at him solely as how impressive is he on his feet in terms of being able to be articulate and everything else, he's the best one out there. There's nobody that bests Buttplug at being able to do that. But he's also not a member of the AOC wing of the Democratic Party. Pete Buttplug is a rising star within the Democratic establishment. He is going to be very much ingratiated with the deep state, meaning that he is perfect pairing for a guy like Joe Biden. The establishment would be more than happy to hand the reins over to someone like Buttplug. And he is the age insurance plan for Biden. And, you know, if they can count on support from non-whites, going for Biden, then they don't really have to pick a non-white nominee. I mean, it's as simple as that. If they can lock down Big Black and Big Brown by scaring those people into voting for Biden, they don't need to run the risk of putting a non-white candidate at the top of the ticket. Why would they? You know?
Yeah, no, you can just shoehorn in butt plug, and then at that point, not only is he a rising star and someone who, as you noted, is very articulate and a smart guy for, you know, whatever you think of the positions that he takes, you know, boom, he's the vice president. He's got as good a shot as anyone. You know, he's sort of the presumptive nominee. Of course, they don't really do succession in sort of the straight-laced way that the GOP had been known to do it prior to Trump, as like with Romney.
Yeah, I just don't know that the Democratic Party is going to be fooled by a butt plug at this late juncture. I mean, if I can tell that butt plug is very carefully honing his rhetoric in such a way that he can just be an establishment shill while also not scaring off the new Democrats. I mean, they're going to see that he's inauthentic too. And then what it is, it's like, okay, so like we're supposed to like this guy because he's gay. Like what are his issues? I can't tell you where Buttplug stands on the issues because he's very careful about not taking a position, which is sort of leaving him, which is a smart strategy if you can fool these people. But the reality is it's like it's getting harder and harder to like pull that off. They're going to have
well, they also have people helping them now, be it AOC type elected politicians or, you know, these very loud, you know, POC in the media will be sort of helping them sift through that. It's, you know, who can break down, who can actually be like, yeah, okay, what this guy just said sounds great, but it's actually nothing but platitudes.
Yeah, and that's kind of where you're at. And that's what the shit tests within the Democratic Party have really been all about. It's like, where do you stand on reparations? You know, and then the politician gives some sort of trademarked poll-tested answer.
Rising tide lifts all boats, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah, and then it's like, yeah, okay, but, like, how does it help Black Pippo?
What about them cash payments?
Specifically Black Pippo. And it's like, guys, like, you can't pull the wool over people's eyes anymore. Like, just like Donald Trump. Like, people are going to be, you know, people on the right should have a healthy amount of skepticism to the next guy that comes along and does that bit. I mean, I love Tucker Carlson. He does a great job. But if Tucker came out and ran for president, I would still be skeptical because of what happened with Donald Trump. Now, Tucker doesn't have like jewelry all around him, and his daughter is not Ivanka married to Jared Kushner. And I would, you know, see how Tucker did. But that's the problem. It's like you had a guy like Trump come out and promise the world and then give nothing. And I think if they trust someone like Biden or Buttplug, it's not going to work out well, because I think what's going to happen is the establishment wing of the Democratic Party, if Biden wins, is going to act like they won. And that, I think, is going to cause even more division within their party. If they try to go back to like neoliberal business as usual, the AOC wing's not going to fucking take that. So I don't know.
Yeah, the question becomes, do we want this to fall apart now or do we want it to fall apart later? And obviously, everyone is sort of unanimously answering later, knowing that later is coming. You know, like the conversation we were having before we went on air, that seems to be, you know, why everyone is sort of frozen in place and doesn't want to even bring up Biden's past positions in any meaningful way, let alone, you know, start cutting ads with the, you know, scary voiceover guys talking about his opposition to busing. It's like, do I really want to start this ball? You know, and so like we were talking about Nancy Pelosi in the first hour. I think she's like, we were talking about, you and I are faced with uncertainty trying to predict and decipher all of this stuff that we, you know, never faced before. When it was business as usual, it was very easy. I think Nancy Pelosi's kind of in the same place. She's like, yeah, I can do X, Y, Z, but I don't know what's going to happen after that.
Yeah, well, and she also doesn't know. She also doesn't know whether Biden is going to win or not. And I think part of Pelosi's calculation is that she wants to retain control of the speakership, and she loses control of the speakership if she allows impeachment to move forward. Let's be honest, because all of that high watermark that she attained in 2018 with the midterms is going to get washed away, and she's gone from the speakership. So her focus is retaining the speakership. And if she believes that there's nobody on the Democratic side that can beat Trump because of the economy or because he's in control of the White House, it's very difficult to unseat an incumbent. She's playing the
long. If they impeach, the Senate doesn't convict, and then for whatever reason, Donald Trump wins, whether it's because of that or something else, she's fucked. Yeah.
She's fucked, and if they win the House, I mean, she will not only lose her speakership, she will be probably trotted right out of Congress by the base, the Democratic base.
Well, you're supposed to resign after you lead your party to electoral doom. That's what she should have done after last time and never come back. But yeah, no, she'll go from, you know, being the greatest, most masterful speaker and legislator and blah 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 to the one who made the biggest fucking blunder ever and a total dog for all time.
Yeah, well, and
she doesn't want that.
Well, and in turn, it will accelerate the division within the Democratic Party too. It's going to flush her right out, and anybody else who stood with her is going to get excoriated. But she has the most to lose.
Like Hakeem Jeffries, he knows where his fucking checks are signed.
Oh yeah. Oh, yeah. So, well, there is this good article talking about sort of the future of the Democratic Party and what could happen. This is called Joe Biden and the End of Neoliberalism. This is from The Week. I just want to read a couple quotes, quite a few quotes, actually. But this is a good article. Until Tuesday, it was possible to assume that most of these early Biden supporters were low-information voters who were paying little attention to the race and naming the former vice president and senator to pollsters mainly because they are familiar with him. But the new Quinnipiac poll indicates that, on the contrary, by far the largest portion of those who are paying, quote, a lot of attention to the contest, 42% of them, support Biden. Sanders, meanwhile, has only 8% of those who are most engaged, and the greatest portion, 28%, of those who are paying little or no attention. That almost doesn't make sense to me. If Biden maintains his frontrunner status through the summer's debates and benefits as the first candidates drop out, in the Quinnipiac poll, 17 candidates are polling at or below 1%, so some of them are bound to quit soon. It will be a powerful sign that the party is resolved to take its stand against Trumpian populism in the name of neoliberalism, the centrist technocratic ideology that powered the presidency of Bill Clinton, Obama, blah, 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 whatever. Whatever the outcome of such a contest, it is likely to be the last of its kind. The TLDR here is because boomers, essentially. but it's also because, yeah, I mean, this is sort of what they're this is the darkest scenario that they're putting out there. So Biden wins the nomination, provoking a third party run by someone who rallies the disaffected left wing of the party, which I don't think is impossible. Bernie says that he won't do it. And I think that the frustration from that decision, and if Biden becomes the nominee, especially in a stolen convention, that someone else would do a third party run. I don't know who that person
would be. Yeah, the people's anger is there. Whether Bernie exploits it, you know, if he feels that he's above that or he's too big for that or feels it's not the right move. What matters is that it's there.
Yeah.
Some other enterprising individual can come along.
Yeah. Well, and in this process, this challenge from the left takes votes from the party's nominee, who is then defeated in November. While a handful of starry-eyed socialists might support such a move in the hopes that this left-wing challenger could defeat both Biden and Trump, the reality is that this would be a kamikaze run intended to torpedo an unacceptable neoliberal nominee. So that's the worst case scenario. The better possibility that they say is that Biden wins the nomination, the left grumbles, gets nastier against on Twitter, but ultimately comes around to supporting Biden. I just don't see that happening, especially if they have to like steal the nomination. But maybe that's why they're trying to like meme him as the front runner to just avoid that process if they can. So
yeah, and everyone seems to be remarkably on board with the plan, which leads me to wonder when someone does, you know, start bringing up those issues or cutting some ads like the ones, you know, I was invoking before, that person's probably, you know, if people are like, all right, you know, it's Biden, whatever, he's not perfect, but this is it, man, gotta be.
Well, the number one,
whoever is the first person who comes out and does that is probably gonna be fucking met with vitriol if everyone's like, look, I've signed on to this and you're not fucking it up.
Well, if stopping legal immigration, building a wall, and stopping illegal immigration are the number one, two, and three issues within the Republican Party. You know what the number one issue in the Democratic Party is in poll after poll after poll? It's not healthcare. It's not immigration. It's getting rid of Donald Trump is the number one issue. And so I do actually think that there is some merit to the argument that there may be some practicality in the form of wanting to get rid of the orange racist in the White House. And they may tolerate a Biden if they think Biden can win. That's why you're seeing so many of these polls that show Biden ahead. And it is possible that they can sort of, I don't know.
This is going to have to be done deftly and will require a great deal of skill, and it will require discipline on the part of all involved.
Yeah, I just don't, like you say, all of Biden's issues. The question is, will the need to defeat Trump on the left be surpassed by those other issues? I mean, are there going to be, you know, non-whites that say, well, what about this? Are we really going to put up with, I mean, I don't know. It's going to take a lot of self-control, which I don't think they have. I mean, I don't know. But they sort of go on to make the case in this article so let's say that they all sort of be practical and have a bitter pill that they swallow and go with Biden. This scenario would end in one in two ways. If Biden were to lose, the recriminations would make the battles stirred up by the Clinton-Sanders smackdown of 2016 look like a good-natured spat. The left would demand blood and the revolution would claim a lot of victims. Oh, yeah.
That's something that you don't want to have to happen two times. You know, you say, all right, we need to go with this guy for the sake of electability. And then that person loses, not once, but twice. I know I wouldn't be very fucking happy.
No. I mean,
I've been there.
Oh, yeah, I've been there. And imagine if Jeb had become president and it just went into a shit show. And then, like, in 2024, you were told that, like, Jeb is the only way that we defeat these people. It's like, oh, my God. Or no, not Jeb, Romney. Just somebody else. Another person of the same. Because that's what Biden is, right? So this is where they go with the neoliberalism being sort of dead. But what if Biden were to win the nomination and then defeat Trump? Wouldn't that validate the conviction of so many establishment and rank-and-file Democrats that neoliberalism is the default ideology of a country increasingly clustering in the center-left? Wouldn't it ensure that this ideology maintains its hold over the party going forward? Don't bet on it. Neoliberalism is under assault around the world by the far right, by the young who long for something beyond what they see as its consensus-focused complacency and accommodationism. This is a generational battle. Biden's supporters are old. The young favor far more left-wing Sanders or Warren. It's only a matter of time before those who gravitate to neoliberalism pass away. Yeah, so it's basically like this is really their last shot at a Biden-type candidate. So maybe that's why Hickenlooper and Inslee and Bullock and de Blasio are all getting in the race, because it's like the last chance for a white man to run in the party.
Yeah, you know, it's funny, everyone, you know, the people who think about things in a serious way on both sides seem to be aware that after the boomer death occurs, it's, this shit's going to be like Thunderdome.
It really is. It really is. Because, I mean, the division is just so insane now. That's why I didn't really understand Trump's thinking in wanting to do an infrastructure bill with the Democrats. I mean, well, not his thinking, but their thinking. Why would they actually entertain this? Why would they actually want, why would they ever want to work with him on infrastructure? They don't want to be caught. They can't be caught dead voting on a bill that's got Trump's signature on it. No way. So, I mean, it's already gotten so bad. They can't, the only thing that they agree on, like I said before, is, you know, celebrating Jews and condemning white nationalists. That's the only common ground that these two parties have anymore. There's none otherwise.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, it's, I don't know. I don't know what's going on with this primary. It's starting to get a little boring. It's like, how many of these fucking articles can I read? But thankfully that first debate is in it's been like almost a couple weeks now.
Yeah, it's in a couple weeks. I mean, it's going to get as these people start to drop out, it's going to start to get more interesting. I think because there's so much movement and people don't really believe if Biden is going to be the front runner, and a lot can happen too. Biden can fuck up. Biden can be quickly not the front runner just as quickly as he became the front runner. And then they have a Bernie problem that they have to contend with. And the other question that isn't answered is when these people drop out, who's the support going to go to? That polling on like people who support Bernie or people who are not paying attention doesn't really make any sense to me. And in fact,
no, Bernie Sanders is not for the faint of heart, politically speaking.
No.
Yeah, that makes no sense whatsoever.
Yeah, well, and the other thing is like, how long does Warren stay in? Does her support is going to obviously go to Bernie? Then, you know, if Bernie has a solid 30% floor of support, it's the convention's going to be a shit show. Like, there's no way of avoiding the fight that they're going to have. Just like there's no way of avoiding Joe Biden's past positions on these things. Now, I could agree with the argument that, okay, yeah, nobody's really going to give a shit about Joe Biden touching women. Like, who gives a fuck? But this stuff with the past positions on race, he's going to have a hard time. But, you know,
the busing, dude, ending segregation has been, you know, it's like the first commandment. It's a fucking religious thing at this point. You know, and as I said before, these people aren't going to understand that Joe Biden couldn't support that because he's a politician. And when I say politician, I mean specifically, unlike the fucking Sanhedrin that did that, he had to stand for election and nobody fucking liked that shit.
Yeah, and I think they're just counting on like blacks just generally being low intelligence, because they could sell Obama as a candidate who was going to, I mean, people actually believed that Obama was going to like put an end to race issues in America. Like, people actually believed that. Stupid people, but people actually believed it. And it actually made them worse, Obama.
More brown people or brown people in higher profile positions is never going to alleviate any sort of race issues.
No.
It's just,
no way.
It's not the way this thing goes.
No way. And Biden, I mean, these people who are like interested, I mean, what has Trump actually done that's based? I mean, he said some things, but the J left and the media has successfully whipped these people up into a frenzy into thinking Donald Trump is an orange racist white supremacist, all this shit. He's really not. People who participated in Charlottesville are being prosecuted. He's not stopping any of his supporters from being censored. He is not really doing anything that is benefiting white people in any measurable way other than just being a white person that is in the White House. So I don't really, and the idea that like Biden being in the White House is going to be any different for these people, their life is still going to be shitty because of who they are. So I don't, you know, I don't know what sort of, I mean, you can't really, I'm sort of projecting a level of intelligence onto these people that just doesn't exist, but it's like, you know, I could see them buying into Obama because, you know, Obama was going to like do something specifically for them, which is always what they're asking for of these other candidates. But what's Biden going to do? Well, Biden might even make things worse for them, because the way that, you know, Biden's just going to carry himself as the president. So I don't know. It's yeah. But these people aren't thinking about that in any meaningful way. So I don't know, man.
He's going to save him. He's going to save him from Mitt Romney, who wants to put him back in chains.
Yeah, I'm going to put y'all back in chains. Yeah. That's sort of the rhetoric, you know. And the funny thing and the sad thing is Biden is going to run with that rhetoric as the nominee, of course, in a general against Trump. But what's it going to be met with? Is it going to be met with Trump standing up for white people? No, it's going to be Trump talking about how low black unemployment is and, you know, how many Hispanics love him and are on the stage and yada, yada, yada. You know, so that's the way it'll go. You know, it would have been nice. You have a guy that's going to stand up for you, but it ain't going to be Biden, and it ain't going to be Donald J. Trump.
No, it definitely is not. Yeah, there's there's other Biden issues, but I think we've been covering him. I don't know. Plus, like, talking about Biden's issues, like, I don't know if they're never going to go anywhere. It's just going to be fucking me and you sitting here talking about it.
Yeah, I mean, the China thing was only interesting because of the trade war and the interplay there, and basically Joe essentially going out there and saying, like, collude on my behalf, China, please. I'll do anything you want. I mean, that's what he's saying. The interesting thing about that rhetoric is that it's not what white working class voters in the Midwest that he's trying to convince to vote for him want to hear. So he's got to figure out a better rhetoric.
Oh, yeah. I mean, whatever happens with the race, I mean, what Biden needs to do personally.
Oh, yeah.
Is going to be a hell of a high wire act.
Yeah. Yes, it is. Did you see the story about his son? I was gonna read this with Ethnarch, but we didn't get to the Democrats at all. But this is in Breitbart News. Breitbart News has exclusively obtained a heretofore unreported police report from days before the 2016 presidential election that describes how a cocaine pipe, not a crack pipe, like if it's Hunter Biden, we're gonna call it a cocaine pipe, right? that authorities determined was used to smoke crack cocaine was found in a rental car returned to an Arizona Hertz location in the middle of the night. Also found in the vehicle were several personal effects of Hunter Biden, then Vice President Joe Biden's son, like two of his DC driver's licenses. Why he has two, I don't know. Multiple credit cards and personally identifying information like a... where the fuck is this? Like a Delaware Attorney General badge. Why the hell does he have that? And a U.S. Secret Service business card, which I'm sure the Secret Service gave to him and said, hey, buddy, you ever run into any problems, just give us a call, okay? Just don't call us to pick you up from a rental lot with a crack pipe in your pocket. Blah, 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 blah. Hunter Biden. Go ahead.
I'm hard pressed to figure out what he did take with him, upon departing from this rental vehicle.
That was,
because it seems to me like all the shit that he left was the wrong stuff.
Yeah, this
it's like incriminating stuff and like 10 forms of ID.
Yeah,
way to go, dude.
Yeah, this guy is high as fuck, probably. Hunter Biden, according to the police report, had rented the vehicle from a location in California with the intent to return it to Prescott, Arizona, where it was discovered in the morning after it was dropped off with the drug paraphernalia and hiding Bunner. What the hell was he doing? Renting a car to go from California to Prescott and just like smoking crack on the I-5 or on the I-10, like, woo! Like, So
it's like some fear and loathing in Las Vegas shit. Yeah. Just roll up, be like, all right, I'm done with this.
Well, dude, just
fucking get out of here.
Just Google a picture of Hunter Biden. Like, oh my God, dude. He looks like, I don't know. He looks, the guy's having a rough life. And so instead of, here's the kicker. Instead of returning the car keys to the Dropbox where the after hours returns are supposed to go, the car was returned, according to the police report, with keys left in the gas tank compartment of the vehicle. Also found inside the vehicle, per the police report, were two driver's licenses, both bearing his legal name, as well as credit cards, blah, 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 blah. The Hertz employees thought, and police later confirmed, that the pipe that was found was used to smoke illicit drugs, and there was a white powdery substance in the armrest of the vehicle. yeah, here we go. Next morning, according to the police report, a man who identified himself as Joseph McGee called the Hertz rental counter to inform them of how the keys to the car were left in the vehicle's gas cap rather than in the normal spot. McGee informed the rental car company, according to police, that his friend was feeling sick, so they didn't know what to do. Jesus, this guy.
Oh yeah, just leave it inside the gas cap. It's like you know, that's like if you have a friend who's going to come and you know, get something out of your car or maybe borrow it, and you're not there to turn it over to them, and it's like oh, I'll just do that. It's like you're at a fucking car rental place, bro. I'm sure there's somewhere you're supposed to put it. Like, how you got to be really fucking high to do this whole bit.
Yeah, well, and this is the same guy, by the way, that was stooping his dead brother's wife while he was still married to the same woman of I think 25 or 30 years and had kids with her, and then divorced.
Yeah, makes more sense. It's an idea that I'm sure sounds much better when you're fucking coked out of your gourd.
yeah. So, yeah, then divorces his wife of 25, 30 years, however long it was, leaves child with single mother, and then eventually breaks it off with the widow, who actually the widow broke it off with him because I think she had a problem with his personal lifestyle. You think so?
Yeah, I don't know. It doesn't seem like she had very many scruples, but
no,
it's whatever. She's I put the blame for that on him in such a situation.
Yeah. Well, why don't we knock out this Poland shit here at the end and then get the fuck out of here? Because I keep copying this prep over from like multiple episodes, and it was your bit and you wanted to get it done. So.
Oh, yeah. I was just going to. I know the tedious guys have covered it at length. I was willing to just let it slide, but it is very juicy stuff. We'll just kind of go in order here. So Poland cancels Israeli visit over World War II property restitution row after a mass protest in Warsaw. This would have been, you know, a couple weeks ago now. So, yeah, the delegation was due to arrive on Monday, but the trip was called off because the Israeli side made last-minute changes in the composition of the delegation, suggesting that the talks would primarily focus on the issues related to property restitution, according to the Polish Foreign Ministry. On Saturday, thousands of people took to the streets of Warsaw to protest against U.S. pressure on Poland to compensate Jews who lost assets during the Holocaust. American legislation known as the 447 Law, or Justice for Uncompensated Survivors Today, JUST Act, requires the State Department to supervise the progress of countries, including Poland, on the restitution of Jewish properties seized during the Holocaust. Polish protesters against the legislation say it could ruin the country's economy, which, well, it's going well. Poland is not exactly a rolling in dough. It's just, you know, they've
done
some fundamental things, right?
That's the point. They want to ruin the economy so that they're on the hook for the EU central bank loans, and then they control them completely. That's the whole purpose of this. It's you know, some of it has to do with the Holocaust and in getting some sort of justification for bilking these people, but it's really about bringing the Polish. It's about bringing these states under their control, and it's actually pretty heartening. To know that there are protests going on against the U.S.
Yeah. Well, this was the article because it was Moik that brought this to my attention when we were doing the show together. And like I said, I know that they've been talking about it on Tedious. Yeah, I guess part of the protests in Warsaw was at the U.S. embassy specifically. So the protest took place amid a dramatic rise in anti-Semitic hate speech in public life in Poland, and it appeared to be one of the largest anti-Jewish street demonstrations in recent times.
Oh yeah, if you oppose this, it's anti-Semitic, right? Of course.
Yeah, these people fucking, you know, the international community literally trying to fucking loot your shit.
Loot your shit and destroy any hope of an independent Poland that is not under control of the EU. Yeah, I mean, it's the same treatment that they gave to Viktor Orban, you know, regardless of you know, whatever perceived faults that there are there. They did the same thing. He's a dictator. He's an autocrat. And they're going to start doing it with Poland, too. It's just fucking disgusting. I mean, look at the uproar that was had over Poland saying you can't call them Polish concentration camps anymore. Like, that was literally another Shoah when they did that. So I'm glad Poland is doing this, and they should have all of our support when they're doing it. But man,
I guess one of the individuals at this thing was being interviewed, and they said, "Why should we have to pay money today when nobody gives us anything?" said 22-year-old Camille Wentzvel. I don't know if that W is supposed to be a W or a V, or I don't know. It don't matter. None of this matters. Americans only think about Jewish interests and not Polish interests. Yeah, well, I gotta say you're spot on there, bud, speaking on behalf of America. The protests in Warsaw target U.S. law S-447, blah, 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 known as the Just Act. Protesters said paying compensation would ruin Poland's economy, but Jewish organizations, particularly the World Jewish Restitution Organization, have been seeking compensation for Holocaust survivors and their families, considering compensation a matter of justice for a population that was subjected to genocide. Poland is the only EU country that hasn't passed laws regulating the compensation of looted or national property, and the head of the WJRO, Gideon Taylor, noted Saturday that such property continues to benefit the Polish economy. At least two U.S. Confederate flags were visible at Saturday's protest, which began with a rally in front of the Prime Minister's office before the protesters walked over to the U.S. Embassy. Men in Native American headdresses held a banner with a message pointing to what they see as U.S. double standards. USA, practice 447 at home. Return stolen lands to the descendants of Native tribes. There you fucking go, guys. I like it.
Yeah, yeah. That is good. That's good. That's the way to do it. Those are good. That's good optics. Yeah, this whole thing is just extremely frustrating. But, I mean, you know, you see them admit this, that neoliberalism is under attack around the world. And yeah.
Yeah, man. Dogs don't like the food.
No.
It's a problem.
Nope. And it's all coming apart. And this idea, look, I mean, look what they've done. I mean, you stamp out dissent and you get people in the streets. And that's what is happening in Poland. Like, they have made it impossible for these discussions to be had in any other form but on the streets. Same with France. And they have not learned their lesson, and this is why, like, when you combine the fact that the U.S. can't just go invade Iran like they want to, and they can't just topple Assad, and they don't like the discussions that are being had, the anti-Semitism is on the rise, and then you have stuff like this going on in Poland, the only thing that one can conclude is that these people are going to have to shake things up in order to change the dynamics of the game, because the more they stamp out dissent, the more of this that they're going to get, and the more they silence opposition, the worse it's going to get. And they're going to, it's like this catch-22, right? The more they do this because of mass media saturation, the more people are aware of this problem. They can't hide this anymore. They can't string people along. They can't sell people these shitty candidates. Nobody wants nobody wants to eat the kosher sandwich. It's all being rejected, so they have no choice but to shake it up, and that's what actually has me worried. about what these people are capable of.
No, I mean, the only fucking people who went along with such absurd nonsense were white people. But you screwed that up, you know, by making it clear to them that you want their countries to be invaded, you want their fucking sons on, you know, HRT and the fucking all of it, the whole program. It's like, I don't know, you know, it really defies logic, you know, when you get down to it. But we know that these people have issues with self-awareness and self-control and so on and so on. And, you know, here we go again.
Yeah, because 50,000 foot view, hindsight is, well, they should have, like the GOP, they should have thrown people some wins on immigration, and they could have avoided Trump. The Democratic Party should have thrown these people some wins in order to avoid AOC. Or they at least should not have, like, gone rooting for this, like, third world fucking mud sludge to come to be ascendant. Somebody, and I'm sure in closed door discussions when they were discussing the coalition of the ascendant strategy, there were some people that were like, what are you doing? What are you doing there? That's not a good plan. But, how, you know, within the Democratic Party, they still have to answer to the same people that want to replace whites, too. So nobody's going to be like, yeah, we're not doing coalition of the ascendant, because it's like, that's the plan.
Yeah, you know, and then the GOP and the GOP base, the greatest thing about AOC, I mean, obviously just all these media stories and stuff, but it's like, you guys don't seem to understand that in a universal suffrage democracy, immigration and who gets into the country is very much a part of the playing field. You either didn't understand that, or you pretend not to, or you pretend not to care or whatever, but it's clear that AOC animates you. How many of these fucking people do you want in Congress? Because that is what we are talking about here. Fuckwit.
Yeah. Yep. And they're not going to be able to bring these people under the control. I mean, maybe they can sort of manage Ilhan Omar, who has been noticeably quiet lately, by the way. Been very, we've almost had no Omar news, or at least I haven't seen it. But yeah,
she gets, you know, they fucking crack the whip on her and she shuts the fuck up for a while. We haven't heard the last of Ilhan.
Yeah,
it's not possible.
No, it's not possible, because she sees the things for what they are too, and it's impossible once you start noticing. It's impossible to just shut the fuck up and say nothing. And she's got
no. Next time is Israel, you know, uses live ammo on 40 or 50 people protesting at their border, you know, she'll chimp out again. I mean, those situations are going to get to the point where they can't happen anymore.
Well, that's why they can't do a war, because if they did a war on behalf of Israel, now they have people out there who are going to say it, and they have a very hard time of getting those people to shut the fuck up. And the last thing that they want is people out there saying it. The funniest thing is, I don't know whether this was in a dream or whatever, but I mean, could you imagine the reaction if, you know, how it's just like universal condemnation of Omar whenever this stuff happens, and, you know, it's just like put to bed, and then there's like resolutions against white nationalism and anti-Semitism and all this stuff. Wouldn't it be funny? I mean, I know this is never going to happen, but just imagine the reaction if some lone member of Congress, like almost like a golf clap, it just started, and instead of coming to a microphone to do round condemnation of Omar, they said, you know what? Maybe Israel does have too much power. I'd like to say that I stand with Ilhan Omar. Could you imagine if, like, you just all of a sudden had people doing that? It's never going to happen, but just the absolute visceral reaction in the media. Like, I don't know what these people would do. Probably hit the fucking go button, I would guess.
Yeah, I don't know. I'd just be sitting there in awe myself. I mean, yeah. That's the one thing. You know, there's a couple consolation prizes, and one of them is the entertainment value of all this. I suppose that's something.
Yeah, and I think actually the picture that I'm painting is not as unrealistic as one might think. All they need is more Omars. If they get enough of these people, and they won't be able to stamp out, you know, these anti-Semitic remarks. You'll have Omar say something because she noticed something happening. And then there'll be Tlaib. And then there'll be, you know, Congressman A, B, C saying, you know what, I stand with Omar. Jews, shut the fuck up.
Yeah, it's not, you know, she's a Somali Muslim, so she's, you know, unique in that respect. But while these people don't necessarily share her particular motivations, you know, the dynamic of identifying with the Palestinians because Ma Brown people is... That's why she has support. That's why she's not... That's why she hasn't been shut the fuck down already. Like, they were like... They tried to do it, and then they were like, oh, this is the thing now. I thought this was just like...
an anomaly. Or just...
TRS talking points.
Yeah. I thought this was something that we were just gonna put up with. You know, to try to... What benefit are we getting from this? And the reality is not much. So I sort of wonder if they're gonna rethink this idea of... sort of carpet bombing these Midwestern cities with people from these countries. I think they're going to be a little bit more selective about injecting these people into the different parts of the country. Because I don't think this is what, if this what is...
Well, they're fucking Somalis, dude. They're literally the shittiest people on earth. If they didn't think about that before or realize that before... you know, and Omar, like, she's of, like, probably, like, the best fucking stock you could imagine.
Yeah, yeah, oh, they're, oh, yeah. If you, especially if you've ever spent time in Minneapolis or one of these cities where there's a high concentration of them, it's really, the phenotype is really pretty disturbing. Yeah, I don't know. You think they could have come up with some other way to brown America than something that was going to blow back on them in this way? But I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know what drove them to, you know, put the fucking, you know, as Mike said, literally the shittiest people on earth in one of the, like, nicest, most high trust, you know, community type regions in the country where people are mostly of Nordic style. I mean, it's just hatred.
Yeah, it is.
They weren't thinking about it.
It is a hate crime. All of this stuff is, that's the real hate crime, is what they're doing to us. So, anyway, we'll leave it there. I had some bottom of the stack stuff, but we'll have to save that for Saturday, I think. So, hope everybody has a good rest of their week. Halberstram, as always, you got anything else? Any parting words? Or are we out of here?
Nah, I will see you on Saturday.
Alrighty. You guys have a good rest of your week.